you are in that micro world where you can be whoever you want.
But what future does it have in the era of the smartphone? A century in a click, 100 years of the photo booth with me, Alan Dean, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Tuesday afternoon at 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 7th of May. Good morning. This is Today with Katya Adler and Justin Webb.
The headlines this morning. Health officials have said the wider risk to the public from the virus on a cruise ship is very low after it emerged that two British people who'd been on board are now self-isolating back in the UK. We'll hear from the chief scientist at the UK Health Security Agency. And President Trump has predicted that America's war with Iran will be over quickly, but Iranian officials have been less optimistic about a peace deal.
And also in today's programme, we'll hear from the boss of the National Cybersecurity Centre on a perfect storm of rapid technological change and rising geopolitical tension. President Obama says he's confident there aren't any little green men or alien spacecraft being hidden in government facilities because they wouldn't be able to keep it a secret.
Some guy guarding the installation would have taken a selfie with one of the aliens and sent it to his girlfriend to impress him. It would leak.
We'll be asking, what is it about America and their fascination with UFOs? Plus, our celebration of Sir David Attenborough at 100 reaches his iconic series, The Life of Birds, and one in particular that caught the eye, the lyrebird.
He also, in his attempt to outsing his rivals, incorporates other sounds that he hears in the forest. That was a camera shutter. And that's a car alarm.
The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
The UK Health Security Agency says the risk to the public from hantavirus remains very low after it emerged that two British people on board the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak have returned home. The pair are now self-isolating. Their exact location has not been revealed. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The British pair left the cruise ship at the island of St Helena and flew back to the UK via Johannesburg. They didn't have symptoms but contacted health officials when they heard of the hantavirus cases on the ship. In cooperation with international health authorities, contacts on their journey home are being traced. The UK HSA also said British people currently on the ship would be flown back to the UK on a charter flight, probably from the Canary Islands, as long as they don't have symptoms. They would then have to self-isolate or be put into quarantine, possibly for up to 6 weeks, depending on the timing of their last potential exposure to the virus. The authorities are working out how this will be implemented. The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public is low and the virus rarely spreads through human-to-human transmission and only after close contact.
A British man who was on board the ship has been flown to hospital in the Netherlands. He's been widely named as Martin Anstey, who's 56 and who'd been working as an expedition guide. He told Sky News that he is doing OK and is not feeling too bad. President Trump has predicted that the war in Iran will be over quickly and has claimed that most people understand his goal of ending Tehran's nuclear ambitions. A US media report has suggested that the White House believes it could be close to agreeing a 14-point memo, which could set a framework for more detailed nuclear negotiations. Iran has yet to respond publicly to the latest American proposals. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Speaking during a virtual campaign event, President Trump told Republicans in the state of Georgia he was optimistic that the war would soon end. He added that most people understood he was right to deny Iran the opportunity to have a nuclear weapon. Speaking earlier at the White House, he insisted that Iran wanted to make a deal and that any hardship caused to Americans because of high fuel prices would be short-term. The US news outlet Axios has reported that a one-page, 14-point memo could form the basis of a final agreement, although a senior member of Iran's parliament has dismissed it as a wish list. Its contents have not been made public. Tehran said it would soon share its views on Washington's latest proposal with mediators in Pakistan.
A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods. The investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct has been going on since January last year. The IOPC says it's linked to reports made by four victim survivors. Mohammed Al-Fayed died in 2023, having never faced any charges. Here's our correspondent Ellie Price.
It was only after the BBC documentary in September 2024, which exposed just some of the sexual abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed, that the Met revealed it had been approached by 21 women before his death in 2023. Hundreds of women have since accused the former Harrods owner of rape, sexual assault and trafficking. The IOPC said it was yet to decide whether any current or former officers have, or would have had if they were still serving, a disciplinary case to answer. It's understood the serving officer is not on restricted duties. A Met Police spokesperson said the force was assisting the IOPC, adding the investigation of the officers did not mean that misconduct proceedings would necessarily follow.
The Advertising Standards Authority is taking action after a BBC investigation found AI-generated characters making false and misleading claims about fitness workouts on social media. These included promises of dramatic body transformations. Disclaimers stating adverts used artificial intelligence were often obscured or missing. Our sports correspondent Katie Gornall reports.
On social media, there are plenty of polished videos of people selling their own fitness journeys and promising dramatic body transformations in just weeks. The results look too good to be true. In many cases, they are. It's often AI. We uncovered AI fitness characters making claims to sell workouts that breach the Advertising Standards Authority codes. These ads included claims such as look 20 years younger in weeks or lose 40 pounds in a month. The regulator decided these statements were unlikely to be backed up and is taking steps against the advertisers. Using AI in adverts isn't against the rules, but making misleading content is. AI videos should also be labelled. We contacted the companies behind the adverts as well as the platforms. They all declined to comment.
Amazon has become the first retailer in the UK to offer a drone delivery service. The Civil Aviation Authority has given approval for a limited trial in Darlington in County Durham. Our business correspondent Emma Simpson reports.
Darlington is the first place outside the US where drones are making some Amazon deliveries. Customers within a limited area can receive their shopping within 2 hours of ordering, so long as it weighs less than 5 pounds and can fit into a shoebox. A garden or yard is needed for the drop-off. The drone's sensors and GPS help detect and avoid obstacles and calculate where to drop the parcel. Deliveries are being limited to 100 a day at first, midweek, but Amazon aims to expand the service.
Football, and Paris Saint-Germain will defend their Champions League title against Arsenal at the end of the month. PSG drew 1-1 with Bayern Munich last night to win the semi-final 6-5 on aggregate.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six. Let us have our first look at the weather. It comes this morning from Darren Bett at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Darren.
Morning, Justin. Well, away from the far north of Scotland, it's actually a dry start this morning. A little bit chilly in places as well. We're going to find some sunshine breaking through, though, at times during the morning before it tends to become more cloudy during the afternoon. And we're also going to find some showers breaking out today, particularly across Scotland and Northern Ireland, but also some of them affecting England and Wales, especially across Wales and the western parts of England. One or two lighter showers are possible in the southeast of England, drifting into East Anglia as well. So that means perhaps the best of the weather is going to be across the Midlands towards Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and that's where we'll see the best of the sunshine during the morning. But the wind direction is changing today. It's still a light breeze for the most part, but it's a southerly breeze, so that means temperatures should be a bit higher. It should be a little bit warmer today. Not by much, perhaps, but typically we're going to find temperatures 14 to 16 degrees. Overnight tonight, there'll be a few more breaks in the cloud, but there'll also be some showers across England and Wales, and a little rain will move from the northwest southeastwards across Scotland as well. Minimum temperatures are going to be around 4 to 6 degrees. But heading into Friday, and Scotland and Northern Ireland looks quite cloudy. It's going to be later in the day before we see some sunshine coming more into the northwest. But there will be fewer showers in Scotland tomorrow. It will be a little bit cooler, mind you. Temperatures around 12 degrees. For England and Wales, there'll be some sunshine at times, but again, we'll see some more showers. But it should be a warmer day with temperatures reaching 18 or 19 Celsius tomorrow in southeast England.
Thank you, Darren. I'm going to hold on to your first words there, which was about sunshine breaking through. It's 9 minutes past six and time for a look at the papers, but we're going to keep non-political. It's election day in England, Wales and Scotland, and we don't cover politics on the day. So if we look at the Daily Mail, were Twitchers to blame for cruise ship rat virus, asked the paper. Officials reportedly believe the hantavirus may have been brought aboard the MV Hondius by a Dutch couple. They visited a landfill site in Argentina to take photographs of birds. Around 150 passengers and crew are still on board the ship. And according to The Sun, the authorities are intensely discussing the next steps when people are brought ashore. A spokeswoman for the World Health Organization warns 8 weeks is a horribly long time to be in quarantine.
The front of the Daily Telegraph features a picture of 56-year-old Martin Anstey, who has been airlifted from the ship, is understood to have been taken to the Netherlands for specialist treatment. Mr. Anstey's wife is quoted as saying it's been a very traumatic few days for his family.
Deal or we'll bomb you to hell is the message to Iran from President Trump on the front of the Times. The paper cites a leaked memo with concessions for Iran, including allowing an eventual return of uranium enrichment to the same levels as under the deal negotiated by President Obama. The Guardian's coverage includes the report from the United States media outlet Axios, which claims Washington and Tehran are close to agreeing a one-page memorandum of understanding.
The possibility of peace between the US and Iran follows what the Daily Express describes as another dizzying 24 hours of twists and turns after President Trump ditched a plan to wrest control of the Strait of Hormuz. But writing in The Eye, James Bell says the latest U-turn shows just how few options Mr. Trump has left in trying to end the unpopular war he started 2 months ago.
It's 11 minutes past six.
We're in a kind of perfect storm, according to the National Cyber Security Centre. Let us talk to Joe Tidy, the BBC's cyber security correspondent. Who exactly is telling us this, Joe, and what are they talking about?
Well, it's the CEO of the NCSC, the National Cyber Security Centre, Richard Horn, and he was up at a conference a couple of weeks ago now, sort of giving his big speech, which he does every year, and that's what he said, a perfect storm of issues around geopolitics, of obviously the tensions rising with Russia and China on the ascendancy and doing incredible, quite astounding scale hacks that we keep uncovering. And then, of course, you've got hacktivists on the side of wherever there's a kind of geopolitical tensions, whether that be Russia or indeed Iran as well. We're seeing these kind of groups rising up to carry out attacks on a kind of ideological basis. Then you've also got the rise of AI and how the way that that is reshaping how we need to think about cybersecurity.
Yeah, and his advice to all of us, and specifically, I suppose, to businesses, but actually it goes wider than businesses as well, is what?
Well, I suppose it's two different messages, really, for the businesses, which is always the one that he's talking to most, is he's talking to CEOs and anyone sort of inside an organization. He's saying you need to be aware of the risks and you need to start taking cybersecurity seriously. To be honest, I've been to these things the last probably 8 years now. I've been uncovering these kind of things. And that message has always been the same. You know, we are not taking cybersecurity seriously. In fact, remember last year, the message was wake up or something like that. That was kind of the tagline. but this year, what he's saying is that we need to particularly worry about AI in terms of there are huge benefits that it'll bring to defense because all the things it can uncover can make our code and make our software safer. But there's going to be what they call a vulnerability patch wave coming. So that means that all of these new problems that the AI are finding, the AI models, like, for example, Mythos or GPT 5.5, which has come out, which is actually as good as Mythos, they're uncovering new things. We need to find a way to patch them quickly before the criminals do. And already we know that organizations around the world are very bad at patching. It is really, really difficult because this is where a software update comes up. And then you've got to find a way to sort of pause work in your organization to do that update to make sure it's safe. So already we're struggling. And now there's going to be this giant wave of vulnerability patching that we need to do.
OK, well, Joe Tidy, thank you. And we will be talking to Dr. Richard Horn at 10 past 8.
It's coming up to 14 minutes past six. The Dutch cruise ship hit with a hantavirus outbreak. We've been hearing so much about the last few days, has left Cape Verde after three people on board were medically evacuated. 150 people are still on the ship, including 22 British passengers. They're all heading for the Canary Islands to a port in Tenerife. But the authorities in the Canary Islands do not want the ship to dock. Well, Guy Hedgeco is reporting for us from Tenerife. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Katya.
So if the Canary Islands doesn't want the ship, what's going to happen?
Well, that's right. The local authorities are unhappy about this decision by the central government to allow the ship to dock. They say that not enough information was shared with them, and they've expressed concerns about possible health risks caused by the ship docking. The central government insists that this is a humanitarian obligation for Spain with the World Health Organization, and also a legal obligation because it says that the Canary Islands has the facilities and the infrastructure to be able to manage this situation safely. Ultimately, this is a decision for the central government. So even though the local authorities don't like this, there's not a great deal they can do about it in terms of the way that the Spanish constitution works.
OK, so the ship is expected to arrive over the weekend. What do we know about passenger self-isolation and repatriation? Because there are quite a number of Spaniards on board, but many other nationalities as well, including British passengers.
Yes, I mean, there are about a dozen Spaniards on board. Now, when the boat arrives, which is expected to be sometime over the weekend here in Tenerife, there will be medical assessments. The passengers are already undergoing medical assessments because there are WHO staff on board doing that at the moment. But when they arrive here, there will be further medical assessments carried out on all the passengers. The Spanish passengers, we're told, will be flown to a military hospital in Madrid and then quarantined. Other passengers, if they're given the all clear, then they will be repatriated. And as you say, there are passengers from many different countries, so that means sending them back to all their countries. But that's as long as they are given the all clear once they've undergone the assessment here.
Mm. Thank you very much for bringing us up to date, Guy Hedgeco.
16 minutes past six is the time. The boss of one of the world's leading fertiliser companies has told the BBC that farmers are delaying purchasing fertiliser, which could, of course, mean less food production and higher food prices in the future. Will has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Katya. Yeah, that's right. Fertiliser, one of those commodities that's seen its price shoot up since the outbreak of the US-Israel war with Iran. In fact, urea, the world's most commonly used nitrogen fertiliser, has seen its price almost double since last February. Fertiglobe is one of the world's biggest exporters of nitrogen fertiliser. It's also majority owned by the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. And I've been speaking to its chief executive, Ahmed Hosey.
For our production that sits inside of the Strait of Hormuz, it's been extremely challenging logistically. Our focus has been to keep our people safe, to keep our assets safe, and to continue operations. And also, you know, where possible, to try to get some shipments out via alternate routes and alternate methods.
And that's included moving things over land, right? In trucks, basically.
Absolutely. So staging and moving, you know, product over by truck into ports that are outside of the Strait of Hormuz. I think we're quite unique, and we have a pretty diversified global footprint. Two-thirds of our production actually sits outside of the Strait of Hormuz in North Africa and Egypt and Algeria. We continue to produce there and sell to global markets. Within the Strait of Hormuz, our production continues to produce as well, but we are not able to export out anywhere close to as much as we did pre-February 28th.
Yeah, just for that product that would have normally been exported through the Strait of Hormuz, how much time is being added by having to make some of those journeys overland to get to another port that's kind of outside of that bottleneck to get it going?
No, it's significant amounts of time to get everything in order to move the product. Individual trucks are about 2,000 times smaller than a typical vessel. So that's 2,000 more movements than you would have otherwise just export straight from our plant off the jetty into a vessel.
Has it been balanced out by the high prices that you're getting from your plants, as you say, that are not affected by the Strait of Hormuz, or have you still taken a financial hit as a company?
No, I'd say it's more of the former. So it's more than balanced out. So the price effect has been significant because, a third of production not into the global markets with urea exports not happening. Ammonia exports, 21% sits inside the Strait of Hormuz. That's also effectively not happening, you know, lower sulfur exports and lower LNG exports. All of that kind of lack of exports from the Strait of Hormuz has resulted in a pretty material price effect. So urea, which is our main product, has gone from the high 400s into kind of the $850 to $950 a ton range. So quite significant, almost an 70 to 90% increase in price, depending on where you are. That price effect has more than offset the volume effect of us selling less over the last couple of months out of the Strait of Hormuz.
And for obviously for our listeners here in the UK, importing at those high prices, what's your sense for how long that price may remain where it is, or indeed how quickly that price may come back down again? We're talking Wednesday afternoon. We're not 100% certain, but it does seem like mood music is that the sides are perhaps, certainly if you believe the Americans, getting closer to a deal here.
So definitely sentiment in and of itself, if the strait were to open and, you know, there would be clarity on safe passage, which I think is easier said than done. But if we can get clarity on a safe passage, I think sentiment would allow for lower pricing and pricing to go down. But at the same time, you know, there's been a little bit of that over the last few weeks. We had a lot of stop starts with ceasefires and everything over the last few weeks. And effectively what a farmer will do and the distributor to that farmer will do will try to delay purchases as much as possible. Now, when it comes to Europe, UK, the US, a lot of the buying's already been done. So actually, that's the good news. So people are planting already and a lot of applications already started. And, you know, they're buying some of this higher priced product in over the last month or two. But if this were to extend out longer, you know, you're going to see that delayed purchase, you get to a position where they can't wait any longer and they're going to have to buy that higher priced product or decide not to apply that fertilizer, in which case they may not even plant at all. So nitrogen fertilizer intensive crops, they need the fertilizer to get these higher crop yields for, you know, crops like corn, wheat, rice. And so those types of crops, if the farmer can't make the math work on these much higher priced inputs, you could have less production, less grain production and higher prices in the future. So a delayed effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And presumably as well, as you've said, the price pretty much almost doubling by your numbers, right? That is going to take some time to come down. Presumably that is not going to come down quicker than when people are going to be thinking about rebuying that again as we move kind of towards the back end of the summer and into the autumn again.
Yeah, I mean, even think about, to give you an example, the U.S., a lot of the farmland sits in the Midwest, which is, you know, right in the middle of the country, the Corn Belt and all that stuff, kind of the northern part of the U.S. Those farmers need to have the product on a barge in the U.S. Gulf Coast at the Mississippi River, right at the southern part, you know, Texas, Louisiana area. They need to have that by mid-May to make it in time for their season. If the strait opens tomorrow, there's no way product will arrive from the Arab Gulf all the way to the Mississippi River within, you know, this short time period of, you know, 8-9 days. You know, it's about also the logistical movements. When it opens, can it get there in time for when that farmer needs it in Australia and Brazil and South Asia or whatever it is? And the other element of it is, it's not just that the Strait of Hormuz needs to open. You need to start generating product again at some of the producers. Some of our peers here within the Strait of Hormuz have been shut down for the last couple of months. They haven't been accumulating product and vessel loads. And even some of the product that sits on vessels right now inside the Strait of Hormuz has already been sold. So it just needs to be delivered. So there's a lot of these kind of puts and takes where it could take a few months to get back to normal. And I will also say, just obviously people weren't as focused on the fertilizer market before, you know, late Feb. The market was already quite tight going into late Feb. So I think it'll go back to still being a tight market, but at least not this parabolically tight one, which is, you know, really straining farmer balance sheets, income statements and global food security.
If there are shocks in the future in the strait, now that we've seen that can be effective, I suppose, from a geopolitical standpoint, are there things that you are having to think about now as a company going forward about your supply chain routes, I guess?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we'll just have to, you know, have some backup alternatives. So for example, you know, we're working with Etihad Rail, which is a railway provider here in the UAE that's looking to kind of add infrastructure, because railing over long distances is often more efficient than trucking. So more rail movements probably across the Emirates and other GCC neighbors. And then probably more loading infrastructure at ports, potentially more jetty space and more loading space there as well. So just look at the different bottlenecks to see how much and, you know, how long you can run for with the straits closed, then it's just kind of that backup option, like the east-west pipeline that Saudi had. It wasn't really operational at full capacity, but then it was run. And then similarly, UAE also with its own internal pipeline network to be able to move some tons outside of the Strait of Hormuz. Looking at those types of options that you can turn on should something geopolitically happen again.
That was Ahmed El-Hosi, the chief executive of Fertiglobe, one of the world's biggest exporters of nitrogen fertilizer. Well, Lindsay James with us this morning. Lindsay, investment strategist at Quilter, to look through the financial markets with us. Morning, Lindsay.
Morning.
Just a quick thought on that then as well. And is that the sort of conundrum that I guess the Bank of England and others still wrestling with about how long and when inflation might spike and hang around for?
Yes, definitely. So they're focused on inflation expectations and keeping those in check, because in time, expectations for inflation tend to flow into the actual number. So they want to keep that anchored at 2%. And at the moment, they're saying that actually in a year's time, we might see inflation at around 3%. And when you look at some of the financial market instruments, things like inflation swaps, for example, those are telling you that there's a lot of opportunity here for it to be a much bigger number. So as we've heard time and time again, it really depends on how long the straits remain closed.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is still a work in progress.
In terms of the talk of peace yesterday and these plans between, certainly from the United States side that the war may be over or coming to an end, much market reaction to that, traders trusting those sentiments?
Yes. So we saw oil prices come down quite sharply yesterday. They started the day around $108 a barrel, and they at one moment were close to $95 a barrel, this morning back at around $100. So a lot of optimism taken from the comments that there is an outline of an agreement that has been put to Iran, and we're waiting to see their response, of course. But I think we have to remember that some of the features of this reflect really something that was put in place in 2015 under the Obama administration. And of course, Trump pulled out of that in 2018. So from Iran's perspective, they were complying with that. And so I suspect trust is pretty low on their side. And that's even before events of recent weeks and months. So there's going to be stumbling blocks to getting something final, so really kind of in place. And I think as well, as we've touched on already, that their influence on the Straits is likely to be more long term. You know, it's potentially a source of revenue for them. It's definitely a source of leverage in ongoing agreements. So I think that means we're going to see that reflected in things like higher freight rates, in higher insurance costs, in larger stockpiles of commodities, things like fertilizer as well. Definitely more businesses we're going to have to build in kind of some security into their supply chain, just in case we're back here again at some point.
Yeah. So we shift to a bit of companies news. Interesting that the share price was jumping of Novo Nordisk, the maker of Wegovy, those GLP-1 drugs, weight loss jabs.
Yeah, absolutely. So Novo had their Q1 results out, but you know, on the face of it, the numbers weren't really indicative of a strengthening business, but their guidance was upgraded a little bit. So the expected profit decline now 4 to 12% the year ahead, rather than the 5 to 13% we saw previously. But that wasn't really the focus. The story was about the launch of their oral weight loss drug, that Wegovy pill. And this is the first quarter that we've seen very strong numbers coming out from it since the launch. And it actually generated around double what analysts were expecting. It's been prescribed about 1.3 million times in just 3 months. So that's one of the strongest launches on record in the pharma sector. Now, it's quite a small part, of course, of total sales at the moment, but this is really the launch pad for what could be an enormous product for them. And they've stolen the march on their biggest competitor, Eli Lilly. Now, previously, Eli Lilly were able to bring a product to market in the injectable space that ended up being the dominant player in that market. So it's nothing, we can't quite say that Novo have kind of really dominated yet, but it's a good start.
The battle in that space continues. Lindsay, thanks so much for your time. Lindsay James there from Quilter.
And thanks to you, Will. And at 27 minutes past six, it's time for some sport with Mike Morning.
Morning, Katia. Let's start with football, shall we? Because we have new Women's Super League champions. That was the moment Manchester City's women celebrated being crowned WSL champions last night. They weren't playing themselves. Instead, the whole squad gathered at the training ground to watch a 1-1 draw between Brighton and their title challengers, Arsenal. It meant that City cannot now be caught in the title race. It is Manchester City's first Women's Super League title for 10 years and ends Chelsea's six-year dominance of the league. Here is the Manchester City's manager, Andre Jurgelitz.
To watch another team play and you cannot do anything to affect the game. So that was the worst 90 minutes so far this year. We didn't expect anything. We knew that everything is in our own hands. So we were definitely planning for win the league against West Ham away. But I'm more than happy to do it already tonight.
Final round of WSL fixtures is this weekend. Next to the men's Champions League, and Paris Saint-Germain emerged victorious from their semi-final second leg with Bayern Munich last night. The defending champions drew 1-1 with Bayern on the night in Munich to win the tie 6-5 on aggregate. Here's Conor McNamara.
A 9-goal thriller in the first leg in Paris a week ago, and the second leg picked up exactly where things left off. An early goal scored by Ousmane Dembele, it ended up being so important. It was set up by Kvaratskhelia. It established a 2-goal lead after just 2 minutes and 19 seconds of the second leg in Munich, and Luis Enrique's team were able to hold on, defend very resolutely against a Bayern Munich team that had been scoring freely all season, but were unable to claw in the 2-goal aggregate deficit that they found themselves behind. There was 1 goal back, very, very late, 4 minutes into stoppages for Harry Kane, who has become just the second player in Champions League history to score in 6 consecutive knockout stage appearances in a row. Cristiano Ronaldo's the only other player to have done that, but it was a night for Kane when 1 was not enough. Paris Saint-Germain will play Arsenal in the 2026 Champions League final.
And that will be on the 30th of May in Budapest. Tonight in the Europa League, Aston Villa take on Nottingham Forest in the second leg of their Europa League semi-final. Forest, we are ahead 1-0 in that tie. Crystal Palace take on Shakhtar Donetsk in the Conference League semi-final second leg. And finally, away from football, one for the parents. Many people who have or have had small children will know the rigours of taking them to and from the various clubs they attend. Well, turns out the recently crowned Masters champion Rory McIlroy is no different.
We were flying back on the Monday afterwards, and she always has a tennis lesson on Monday afternoon, and I thought, okay, maybe today we can, you know, bin the tennis lesson. And she's like, no, I want to play tennis. I'm like, sure, let's go, let's do it. So as soon as we get home, she's the one that rules the roost.
Rory McIlroy there, talking about his daughter, Poppy, who, as he says, clearly rules the roost. Tennis lessons wait for no one, despite you winning the green jacket for a second year in a row.
Mike, thank you for that. New 10-part series starts next week on Radio 4.
A sewage scandal damaging our rivers.
Last time I was here, there was a tampon and there was a condom.
We had an enormous range of animals in the garden, and that also started to disappear.
A story of ordinary folk taking on powerful people.
They told me there's nothing wrong with the River Windrush. Basically, go away and stop troubling us.
I'm Kate Lamble, and I'll be exploring an environmental battle shaped by politics and murky finances. Rinsed.
I'm not accepting it.
Starting next Monday to Friday at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
The time has just gone 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Katia Adler. Time for a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
Two British people on board a cruise ship at the centre of a hantavirus outbreak have returned to the UK and are now self-isolating. Their location has not been made public. Neither is reporting any symptoms. Another British man has been flown to a hospital in the Netherlands. The UK Health Security Agency says the risk to the public remains very low. It's preparing for the arrival of more British nationals once the ship docks in Tenerife. President Trump says a deal to end the war with Iran is very possible. Iranian officials have said they're reviewing a new proposal from the US, but their top negotiator has said Washington is aiming to force Tehran to surrender. A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods. The investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct has been going on since January last year. The IOPC says it's linked to reports made by four victim survivors. The Advertising Standards Authority is taking action after a BBC investigation uncovered AI-generated characters making false and misleading claims about fitness regimes on social media. Experts say they have serious concerns about hyper-realistic AI trainers promising life-changing results in weeks and breaching UK advertising rules by obscuring or foregoing disclaimers stating the adverts used AI. Amazon has begun offering a drone delivery service for a limited trial period in Darlington in County Durham. Eligible customers can receive their shopping within 2 hours, as long as the parcel is the size of a shoebox, weighs less than £5, and can be delivered to a garden or yard.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's 26 minutes to seven, and today millions of people across England, Scotland and Wales are set to vote in the largest set of polls since the general election. Voters in Scotland and Wales will choose who should run their national parliaments, while seats on dozens of councils and mayors are up for election in England. Well, Henry Zeffman is the BBC chief political correspondent, and he joins me now down the line. Hi, Henry.
Good morning, Katya.
So it's election day, long awaited, right? But a frustrating day for you, perhaps, because the BBC, well, like other broadcasters, we don't report details of campaigning or election issues once polls open.
That's right. But we can describe what is up for grabs over the course of the day. So as you said, there are elections in Scotland, Wales and England, not in Northern Ireland, but they are different contests in different places. So in Scotland, 129 members of the Scottish Parliament are going to be elected using a mixture of first-past-the-post constituencies and regional lists. And then in Wales, you have actually an enlarged 96-member Senedd using a new electoral system for the first time. So there will be 16 pretty large constituencies, each electing six members using a proportional system. And then in England, you have more than 5,000 seats on 136 councils being contested. Some of those councils are electing all of their councillors, some of them just a third of their councillors. And in addition, there are six directly elected mayoralties being contested in different parts of England. Polling stations open from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. For registered voters who are over 18 in England, but 16 in Scotland and Wales. And one other slight point of difference is that photo ID is required to vote in person in England, but not in Scotland or Wales.
Now, as you say, Henry, voting ends at 10 p.m. tonight, but results are expected tomorrow and over the weekend, right?
That's right. It's a real sort of sprawling results period. So only about a third of the councils up for election in England are counting and declaring their results overnight. Some of them will be faster than others. No results from Scotland or Wales overnight. So it is important as people digest the results to realise that on Friday morning, that is only going to be a partial account of what is happening in different parts of the country. In fact, there's even a handful of councils which we're not expecting to declare until Saturday. So lots of fun ahead for the real politics heads across the country.
Henry, thank you so much. And a politics head, one of our own, Nick Robinson, will be joined by Rachel Burden. They're going to be presenting live coverage and analysis on Radio 4 and 5 Live of the local elections tonight in England, plus elections for the Scottish Parliament and the Senedd in Wales, as we've heard.
I think Nick is also presenting the programme as well tomorrow morning, so he probably is a politics head, if indeed his head is capable of doing anything by the time he gets to this time tomorrow. Of course it is. 23 minutes to 7 is the time. What's going on between the US and Iran? That, of course, is the big question, but part of it is affected by the Israel-US relationship, and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has been talking about that. Let's talk to Ilan Nel, our Middle East correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. What's he been saying, Ilan?
Well, there was a meeting of the cabinet last night, and afterwards, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu put out a short statement. He said that regarding this possible emerging deal between the US and Iran. The most important goal was to remove the enriched material, meaning the uranium, from Iran to dismantle Iran's enrichment capabilities. And he was stressing that there is full coordination with the US. There would be no surprises. Now, this comes as the US website Axios is saying that the US is expecting this response within 48 hours. That's what we're saying from yesterday. This detail that it's giving, which has not been confirmed by the White House, but it's saying that the US is seeking a moratorium on nuclear enrichment that would last for 12 years, a commitment that Iran would have no nuclear weapons, and it would provide for like the highly enriched uranium stockpiles to be shipped out of Iran, with suggestions that President Trump has told the Israeli Prime Minister that, you know, the deal will not go through unless there is a serious pledge on removing the highly enriched uranium.
And is that good enough for Netanyahu?
I mean, I think the suggestion is that they are prioritizing that. Previously, what the Israelis have been saying is that they want to have Iran's support for proxies around the region dealt with. They want to have its missiles arsenal dealt with as well. But the Israeli newspaper Mariv is reporting this morning that there are senior Israeli officials expressing what they're calling very guarded optimism about the prospects of this negotiated agreement.
Yolande Nell, Middle East correspondent reporting from Jerusalem, thank you. And I should say we will be talking more about what is going on between the US and Iran and what we can actually make of what the various things that Donald Trump has been saying recently, what they actually add up to at 7:30. We'll be talking to someone who has been working at the Department of Defense under Pete Hegseth, but also to an Iranian spokesman.
It's coming up to 20 minutes to 7.
Now, let us turn to matters here at home and the news that five Metropolitan Police officers are being investigated by the IOPC, the Independent Office of Police Conduct, for potential misconduct around the handling of reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former Harrods owner, of course. And Aruna Iyanga is the BBC News correspondent who's been covering this and is here in the studio. Tell us what we know, first of all, Aruna, about the work that the IOPC is doing and what they say they are now doing with these five officers.
Well, this is significant because this is the first time that the IOPC has confirmed that a serving and former officers are being specifically investigated in connection with the Met's handling of reports of sexual offending by Mohammed Al-Fayed. Al-Fayed, as you mentioned, owned Harrods and died in 2023, aged 94, never having faced any charges. There were claims of predatory sexual behaviour. They surfaced in a BBC documentary in 2024.
And those claims were made to the police?
They were made to the police, yes. After the documentary was aired, the Met revealed that it had been approached by 21 women before Al-Fayed's death who accused him of sexual offences. So what we know at the moment is that the IOPC is looking into a complaint against five officers, one serving and four former officers. The investigation involves reports made by four victim survivors and it began in January 2025. The Metropolitan Police says it's assisting the IOPC, but says that the investigation doesn't necessarily mean that misconduct proceedings will necessarily follow. It also says it's actively investigating individuals who may have facilitated or enabled offending by Mohammed Al-Fayed.
That's not police necessarily, it's a wider thing.
That's the wider investigation into people who may have facilitated Al-Fayed.
And it's worth saying, isn't it, that the level of abuse, just the sheer numbers involved, are staggering, actually.
Yes, around 154 victims have come forward and reported allegations of sexual assault, rape, sexual exploitation and human trafficking. So this is a wide-ranging case involving a huge number of people and it's been going on for a long, long period of time.
Final thought about what the Met are saying about the investigation?
Yes, they're still investigating who may have facilitated or enabled offending by Mohammed Al-Fayed. They say that investigation is active. And if you remember, in March, the force announced that three women and a man had been interviewed under caution, but no arrests have been made so far.
Aruna Iyanga, thank you.
It's 18 minutes to 7. For years, Ukraine has been known as one of the world's leading hubs for commercial surrogacy. It's attracted couples from all around the world with lower costs and more relaxed laws. And even after Russia's full-scale invasion, the industry continues to operate. You have fertility clinics that have just been adapting to the war. Now, though, there's a proposed law being debated in Ukraine's parliament that could ban surrogacy for foreign parents. Sofia Betitsa travelled to Kyiv to find out more.
So, we just heard an air alarm, which means that all the babies are being taken to the basement for safety.
We are in a so-called baby room in the outskirts of Kyiv, set up by a surrogacy agency. Here, newborn babies wait for their prospective parents to come and collect them from the UK, Turkey, Brazil and beyond.
No, you can hear that.
You can hear that sound?
Every year, thousands head to Ukraine for surrogacy. The war disrupted this huge industry, but it didn't stop people like Himatraj and Rajveer, who have travelled from London to Kyiv to have a baby.
So you weren't sleeping, you were worried all the time. You could hear explosions, you could hear drones, you could feel tremors and see smoke billowing in the skies from where the attacks were.
Was it under risk?
Definitely. I mean, being able to bring their son back and seeing him every day and being able to fill that dream of ours, it was worth every risk.
But not every surrogacy arrangement goes so smoothly. We found that in many cases, parents delay travelling to Ukraine to collect their newborns, sometimes for months. Svitlana runs a small surrogacy agency.
So you had these twins for 11 months. The intended parents just left them with you.
But don't you think that leaving their babies for nearly a year is a bit selfish and a bit careless?
This is not normal, but unfortunately we have had cases. It happens about 80% of the time. I cried when I handed them over. It hurt. They felt like my own. I was watching them grow up, learning to speak, getting their first teeth. It's still painful for me. Not every baby is collected. At this children's home in Kyiv, we meet Wei, who was born through surrogacy. He was premature and has a severe brain injury. He cannot sit unaided, hold his head, or see properly. When his intended parents were told about his condition, they did not come for him. Cases like this are prompting calls for change. The Ukrainian parliament is now debating a new law that could ban surrogacy for foreign parents.
How often are children born through surrogacy left behind?
There is a lot of children that are left behind.
Valeria Soruchan is from the health ministry.
And it's not only children that are left behind. We don't know where the children go from there. As soon as they get picked up from this country, we don't know what happens to them. Surrogacy is one of the ways for children trafficking. It is.
Would this law solve that problem?
We do believe that it will minimize that.
But for those women who choose to become surrogate mothers, this is a lifeline in a country where war has stripped away their livelihoods. Karina is doing a scan. She's 22 and carrying a baby girl for a Chinese couple. It was a decision she took after her home in Bakhmut on the front line was destroyed. She'll be paid $17,000.
I'm going to do as many surrogate pregnancies as it takes, as long as my health allows. This ban would ruin my plans.
A vote on the proposed ban is expected this year. But for now, many will risk everything, even coming to a war zone, to become parents, while they still can.
That was the BBC, Sofia Betitsa, reporting from Kyiv. Really eye-opening. 13 minutes to seven.
Four Australian women linked to the Islamic State group have been returned to Australia along with their nine children. Australia's government says they're not welcome, but it can't stop them coming. The case has obvious relevance to our own debate over what to do about Shamima Begum and other British women who want to come back here. In a moment, we'll hear from Jonathan Hall, the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. First to Maya Foer, who's director of the human rights group Reprieve, which is working with the families and indeed the lawyers of Britons and others detained in northeast Syria. Maya Foer, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And they're in the same camp, weren't they, as Shamima Begum? What then is the potential link between what has happened to these women and their children and the Brits, or former Brits, I should say, because they are no longer citizens?
Yes, they were in the same camp, and it's a really significant development. What it shows is that the new Syrian government doesn't want to have to maintain these camps forever. They don't want to be responsible for thousands of women and children. And we must remember the majority of people in the camps are children, lots of them, of course, foreign children. And the Syrian government doesn't want to hold these camps indefinitely. And why would they really? So what I think we can derive from that is that governments who have nationals or people have stripped of citizenship who were previously nationals in the camps need to rethink how they're approaching this problem.
Rethink how? What needs to change, do you think, in their approach?
You know, these children, majority of children, British children, women, have been in those camps held indefinitely for some of them nearing 10 years, nearing a decade, without any kind of trial, any kind of due process. So it's already outrageous that they've been left so long. Most of our allies, France, Germany, you know, the US, have been calling on Britain to bring their nationals, these families, home. And many of these countries have done so themselves. And they've prosecuted people where appropriate. They've put them through normal trials, which Britain is perfectly capable of doing. And then, really critically, they have offered support to people who may be victims of trafficking. And we know many, many of the Brits, probably two-thirds of the adult women who are there, are potential victims of trafficking. You know the famous case of, you know, the 15-year-old girl who was trafficked to Syria. There are many, many others like that. So whilst it's perfectly possible to bring home and prosecute, and I think that's the appropriate thing to do in any other circumstance where someone stands accused of a trial, accused of a crime, we put them through a trial.
Okay.
That's what we should be doing here.
Maya Foer, thank you very much for that. And as I say, listening to it, Jonathan Hall, KC, the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, good morning to you.
Morning.
Do you think the Australian, what's just happened with Australia, changes anything?
Not massively. I mean, I think that there was a sort of stasis whilst the Syrian Defence Forces, the Kurdish forces who were carrying out the detentions, were holding the territory, and Bashar al-Assad was governing Damascus. With the change of regime, which the government recognises, and the possibility that the regime says we don't want to carry on guarding these women and children for a long time, I suppose it gives a sort of it opens up further possibilities. I mean, either people will be able to get out of the camps more easily, and if they're Brits, they can come back to the UK. That's their right. Or potentially, I mean, it even opens up the route to deportation or removal between two states, between the new Syrian regime and the UK. So it doesn't change things fundamentally, but it gives it a nudge. And I mean, I tend to agree with Maya that it hasn't been comfortable, particularly, I think, in the case of the children. I mean, there are decent arguments, obviously, for some of the women as well who came out when they were very young. But for the children who were born in the camps, I mean, my view has long been that even though I think I have to accept there will be a degree of risk by some of the children coming back, particularly in their late teens, having been brought up in a heavily Islamic State dominated area, they were complete innocents. So I tend to agree with quite a lot of what she said.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, she points out that people could be prosecuted if they personally are accused of crimes. But you bring up a very interesting added risk, which is that you just don't know, do you, how damaged these people are and how damaged the children are. And that is a risk that some in Britain will say is just not one that we should be forced to take.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is that we don't have I don't think anyone could hand on heart say to the Prime Minister, all of these people will be taken into custody for 5 years where they will be assessed and released only after a strict process of assessment to de-radicalisation. That won't happen because in many cases there just won't be the evidence. And even if there is intelligence or some evidence, the rules of evidence that apply in the UK and the rules that we have about criminal liability mean that it's actually very difficult in practice to prosecute people for doing things a long way away. So there's no guarantee they will come into custody. And that does mean that there will be a degree of risk. I mean, the way in which I've looked at it in the past is the UK does have quite a lot of quite powerful and effective ways of managing risk. And also, by the way, quite a few people came back from joining Islamic State voluntarily. I mean, hundreds came back before things sort of settled down in the camps in 2017, 2018. So, I mean, my overall view is for the children in particular, where, I mean, they are innocent, and for the women who are British citizens, the UK should be able to absorb the risk. But, I mean, the truth is that no one in the sort of security world would thank me for saying that, because the last thing they want to do is to have any person who might present a risk who they've got to keep eyes on.
Very interesting. Jonathan Hall, Casey, thank you very much. And before Jonathan, we heard from Maya Foer, Director of Reprieve.
It's 7 minutes to seven. Now, as we continue to focus on the war in Iran and devastating local and damaging global impact of it all, Norway, meanwhile, has made a lot of money out of the recent energy crisis and spiralling prices with the Iran war, but also after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Norway is now Europe's largest gas supplier, and its $2.2 trillion sovereign wealth fund is the world's biggest. So Oslo is under pressure now from NGOs at home, but also some European partners to use its windfalls for greater good to help Ukraine more or those affected by the Iran-US crisis. Professor Alexander Kaplan joins me now. He's the Deputy Director of the Centre for Experimental Research on Fairness, Inequality and Rationality at the Norwegian School of Economics. Good morning to you. Is it fair to say that Norway is profiteering from global crisis, that it's a war profiteer? Professor Kaplan? Oh, I think we might have just...
Hello?
Oh, Professor Kaplan, lovely to hear you.
Hi.
Did you manage to hear my question?
No, I didn't actually. The sound was lost for a period there.
Okay, well, hello. What I was asking you is, do you think it's fair that, you know, Norway, that prides itself on its moral stance on the world stage, is actually profiteering from global crises right now, that it's a war profiteer?
I think it's a super interesting question. And I think it's important to distinguish essentially between the question of whether or not it's legitimate for Norway to sell at the market prices. So the market prices goes up in a crisis situation when demand and supply is reduced. And you could ask the question, should Norway continue to sell at those prices? I think that is morally acceptable. I mean, we're not profiteering in the sense that we are contributing to the war effort. So I think the moral question is more, what should we do with those windfall gains? So clearly, Norway has earned a lot of money from increased prices of oil and gas due to conflict. And that raises a fundamental moral question about whether Norway should do more with that to help others who are suffering from that war.
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump, he's chastised the UK for not exploiting its oil and gas reserves. But as he did so, he said Norway sells its North Sea oil to the UK right now at double the price. They're making a fortune. So he's pointing the finger at you, but so are some of your Nordic neighbours. What in concrete terms can you do for Ukraine? You're not one of the biggest, you're not one of the lowest, but you're not one of the biggest spenders, or for those suffering from the Iran war? And would it be backed by the public?
I think it would be backed by the public. And we are increasingly helping Ukraine. So, and we are currently, I think, among the four biggest contributors to helping Ukraine.
You're behind Estonia and Lithuania, according to the Oil Institute.
That is possible. I think that's it. The plans for this year is that we're dramatically increasing it. Having said that, I totally agree with you, and I think most Norwegians would also agree with you, that we should increase it and we should increase the support even faster. And I think that's a perfectly valid point. I mean, We have an enormous oil fund, the sovereign wealth fund, mm-hmm. and that gives us a fiscal capacity that most other countries do not have.
Especially right now. Well, Professor Alexander Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us.
6:58. Next week, Radio 4 explores what it means to be a father today.
Victorians kind of fetishized this model of breadwinner masculinity. Half the time, it's not even true.
I'm Horatio Clare, charting the changing face of fatherhood in the UK.
They look to me for everything because it is just me.
And discovering how it came to be in the first place.
Fatherhood is an evolved adaptation. If they had not evolved, our species would never have existed.
A new 3-part series exploring what it means to be a father. The story of fatherhood starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday morning at 11.
It's just gone 6:58, time for the weather with Darren.
Thanks very much, Katya. Good morning. It's a dry start for all but the far north of Scotland this morning. There'll be some sunshine around at times during the morning in particular, but I think it will turn more cloudy during the afternoon. And there is a weather front to bring a band of cloud and patchy rain into the far northwest of Scotland. But ahead of that, in Scotland and Northern Ireland, limited sunshine. There will be some showers breaking out as well. And across England and Wales, some sunshine at times this morning, more cloud in the afternoon, and again, a few showers to come into western parts of England and Wales. The odd light one is possible in the southeast of England, drifting into East Anglia. And perhaps the best of the weather today is going to be across the Midlands towards Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and that's where we'll probably have the best of the sunshine, at least during the morning. The breeze is changing direction. It's picking up a bit in the far northwest of Scotland, but it's going to be a southerly breeze. That means temperatures should be a bit higher today compared with yesterday, and near normal for the time of year, typically 14 to 16 degrees. Overnight, we keep some showers, a bit of rain heading southeastwards across Scotland, minimums 4 to 6 degrees. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, probably not as many showers tomorrow, but still quite a lot of cloud for most of the day. Some sunshine across England and Wales, a few more showers breaking out as well. Cooler in northern areas, warmer in the south, highs of 18 or 19 Celsius.
Darren, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katya Adler and Justin Webb.
It's 7:00 on Thursday, the 7th of May. Good morning. The headlines this morning: two people who'd been on the cruise ship hit by a deadly virus are self-isolating in the UK as preparations are made for the return of British passengers on board. We'll talk to the chief scientist at the UK Health Security Agency after the news. The White House is waiting for Iran's response to its latest peace plan. President Trump has said the war will be over quickly. And Darlington has become the first place outside the US where Amazon makes deliveries by drone.
Coming up in the next hour, preparations are underway in Moscow for Victory Day, the parade marking the Soviet victory against the Nazis in World War II. But for the first time in two decades, there'll be no military hardware on display. Plus, will AI mean fewer graduate jobs or just different ones? And our celebration of Sir David Attenborough at 100 reaches his iconic series, The Life of Birds, and one in particular that caught his eye, the lyrebird.
He also, in his attempt to outsing his rivals, incorporates other sounds that he hears in the forest. That was a camera shutter. And that's a car alarm.
The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
The UK Health Security Agency says the risk to the public from Hunter virus remains very low after revealing two British people on board the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak have returned home. The pair are now self-isolating. Their exact location has not been disclosed. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The British pair left the cruise ship at the island of St Helena and flew back to the UK via Johannesburg. They didn't have symptoms but contacted health officials when they heard of the hantavirus cases on the ship. In cooperation with international health authorities, contacts on their journey home are being traced. The UK HSA also said British people currently on the ship would be flown back to the UK on a charter flight, probably from the Canary Islands, as long as they don't have symptoms. They would then have to self-isolate or be put into quarantine, possibly for up to 6 weeks, depending on the timing of their last potential exposure to the virus. The authorities are working out how this will be implemented. The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public is low and the virus rarely spreads through human-to-human transmission and only after close contact.
A British man is receiving specialist treatment in the Netherlands after being airlifted from the ship. He's been widely named as 56-year-old Martin Anstey and he's been working as an expedition guide. He's told Sky News that he is in isolation and has no idea how long he'll be in hospital. The BBC has not spoken to him. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek reports from the Dutch city of Leiden.
Here at the University Medical Centre, specialists have been treating the patient who's thought to be Mr. Anstey. His condition is said to be stable after previously being described as critical. A 65-year-old German woman was also flown into Amsterdam last night and has been taken to Dusseldorf for treatment. A second emergency flight, carrying a third person airlifted from the Hondius yesterday, is expected to land in the Netherlands later. The remaining 146 passengers on board are now finally heading for Tenerife, on what is expected to be a three-day journey, barring any further problems. The Spanish Health Ministry says no one on the ship has any symptoms of Hunter virus.
President Trump has predicted that the war in Iran will be over quickly and has claimed that most people understand his goal of ending Tehran's nuclear ambitions. A US media report has suggested that the White House believes it could be close to agreeing a 14-point memo, which could set a framework for more detailed nuclear negotiations. Iran has yet to respond publicly to the latest American proposals. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Speaking during a virtual campaign event, President Trump told Republicans in the state of Georgia he was optimistic that the war would soon end. He added that most people understood he was right to deny Iran the opportunity to have a nuclear weapon. Speaking earlier at the White House, he insisted that Iran wanted to make a deal and that any hardship caused to Americans because of high fuel prices would be short-term. The US news outlet Axios has reported that a one-page, 14-point memo could form the basis of a final agreement, although a senior member of Iran's parliament has dismissed it as a wish list. Its contents have not been made public. Tehran said it would soon share its views on Washington's latest proposal with mediators in Pakistan.
Four women and nine children with links to the Islamic State group are due to arrive in Australia this morning after spending years in a detention camp in Syria. Speaking in Doha before boarding a flight to Melbourne, the women said they just wanted their children to be safe. Australia, they said, would be like a paradise after the hell they'd experienced in Syria. Voting is just getting underway at polling stations for elections in England, Scotland and Wales. The first results are expected to come in the early hours of tomorrow morning. Others won't be declared until the weekend. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
Across Great Britain, millions of voters will be electing their representatives today. In Scotland, 129 members of the Scottish Parliament will be chosen using a mixture of first-past-the-post constituencies and regional lists based on a system of proportional representation. In Wales, an enlarged 96-member Senedd will be elected from 16 large constituencies, all using PR. And in England, thousands of councillors and six mayors are being chosen as well. Polling stations will be open until 10 p.m. for registered voters who are over 18 in England or 16 in Scotland and Wales. Photo ID will be required to vote in person in England, but not in Scotland or Wales today. The results will start to come in overnight, but many areas won't begin counting until tomorrow, with some results as late as Saturday.
A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods. The investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct has been going on since January last year. The IOPC says it's linked to reports made by four victim survivors. Mohammed Al-Fayed died in 2023, having never faced any charges. Here's our correspondent Ellie Price.
It was only after the BBC documentary in September 2024, which exposed just some of the sexual abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed, that the Met revealed it had been approached by 21 women before his death in 2023. Hundreds of women have since accused the former Harrods owner of rape, sexual assault and trafficking. The IOPC said it was yet to decide whether any current or former officers have, or would have had if they were still serving, a disciplinary case to answer. It's understood the serving officer is not on restricted duties. A Met Police spokesperson said the force was assisting the IOPC, adding the investigation of the officers did not mean that misconduct proceedings would necessarily follow.
The Advertising Standards Authority is taking action after a BBC investigation found AI-generated characters making false and misleading claims about fitness workouts on social media. These included promises of dramatic body transformations, such as lose 40 pounds in a month and look 20 years younger in weeks. Disclaimers stating the adverts used artificial intelligence were also obscured or missing. The companies behind the ads have declined to comment. Amazon has become the first retailer in the UK to offer a drone delivery service. The Civil Aviation Authority has given approval for a limited trial in Darlington in County Durham. Here's our business correspondent, Emma Simpson.
Darlington is the first place outside the US where Amazon is using drones for some deliveries. Eligible customers within a 7.5 mile radius can order and receive their shopping within 2 hours, as long as the parcel is the size of a shoebox and weighs less than £5. Items include everyday essentials such as toiletries and washing up liquid, to beauty products and batteries. A garden or yard is needed for the drop-off. The drone has sophisticated sensors to avoid and detect obstacles in its path, and with the help of GPS, knows exactly where to drop the parcel from 12 feet above the ground. There'll be only up to 100 deliveries per day during the week for now, but Amazon wants to slowly expand the service when regulations allow.
Emma Simpson reporting.
Thanks so much, Jane. It's 9 minutes past seven. As we heard in the news, two British people who left the cruise ship facing the outbreak of hantavirus earlier in its journey, so before Cap Verde, are self-isolating at home now after potential exposure to the disease. Health officials across Europe and Africa are now trying to identify people who may have had contact with all passengers who left the ship, which set off on the 1st of April for stops in Antarctica and several remote islands in the South Atlantic. Here in the UK, the Health Security Agency, UKHSA, say it's supporting the self-isolating Britons. And meantime, we are hoping to bring you someone to talk to us about that, the Chief Scientific Officer from the UKHSA. We are having a few technical difficulties. The ship itself, with 150 passengers, including the 22 British citizens, is now on its way to the Canary Islands, where it's expected to arrive at the weekend. And despite local opposition from the Canary Islands authorities, Spain's national government says that there is a moral duty to accept the ship. Well, Professor Robin May joins us now, I'm very pleased to say. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You are the Chief Scientific Officer for the UK Health Security Agency. And I'd really like to ask, because everybody keeps being told not to worry, not to worry, but how concerned are you?
Yeah, I would reiterate that message, not to worry. For the broader public not directly involved in this cruise ship, the risk here is really negligible. The key point is that for the individuals concerned, clearly for the individuals who are sick, we are looking very closely at them, working closely to get them better. And for those who've been potentially directly exposed to the virus on the ship or during travel to and from in recent days, those individuals are the ones are the main focus of our attention. For people not associated with the outbreak at all, there's really no cause for concern here.
Because, I mean, what we hear is that there is an incubation period of 8 weeks. So even though we're being told that the passengers on the ship are asymptomatic, surely that will be a concern for them and a concern for the countries that they will be making their way back to.
That's right. I mean, understandably, people who are on the ship and have had contact will be concerned, and that's why we're supporting them very closely and will continue to do so over the next few weeks. As you said, we think the most extreme case of incubation may be up to 8 weeks. Actually, the general expert consensus is now consolidating around probably 6 weeks. And so that's the period of isolation, 45 days that we're likely to be recommending. We have been following up very closely with all the individuals that were affected on the boat, people who've been in contact, and people who've been in contact either on shore during the journey or in, for example, long-haul flights that individuals have taken back to the UK.
As you've heard, Sorry. No, I'm just imagining as you're saying it, you know, getting into contact. But we pass by so many people, don't we, in airports, or as we might be waiting for a bus, on a bus to and from the airport. This must be very hard, this track and trace.
It's quite a big mission, but it's something that we do all the time, actually, for lots of diseases. So you will remember in recent weeks, for example, the meningitis outbreak in Kent, contact tracing really important there too. So for any transmissible infectious disease like this, we have big teams who do contact tracing. And we have a pretty robust system, actually, that really looks in detail at the particular disease and the particular transmission patterns. So for hantavirus, this is actually not that easy to transmit between individuals. So as you mentioned, a quick pass in an airport, for example, is not going to put you at risk. We focus our attention on people who might, for example, have been sat next to a passenger for a long time, several hours on the flight. Those are the people that we are contacting.
And as we've said, there are two British nationals who are currently self-isolating who'd left the ship earlier, and 22 more who are currently on board the ship making its way to Tenerife. Will they be immediately repatriated? And will they be self-isolating, or how will it be organised back in the UK?
So for the two individuals who came back earlier from the cruise before this was identified, you know, we're firstly really grateful for them for reaching out for us. They contacted us to say that they were back and did any support. And they are voluntarily self-isolating. For the individuals that are on the ship at the moment, we're working obviously to repatriate them as soon as we possibly can. The Foreign Office is leading on that. And once they're back, they're going to be asked to self-isolate. We'll continue to support them and their families whilst they self-isolate, probably at home, but obviously depends very much on the individual circumstances, depending on where they live and who they live with, as to what the most appropriate mechanism is for them to self-isolate for the next 45 days.
Of course, that makes complete sense. Professor Robin May, thank you very much. And Professor Robin May is Chief Scientific Officer at the UK Health Security Agency.
14 minutes past seven, news and more bumper oil profits coming this morning, this time from Shell. Will has more.
Then after BP last week, the oil and gas major Shell's announced profits for the first 3 months of this year of $6.9 billion. That was despite some production disruption in the Middle East. Robin Mills is with us, the chief executive of Qamar Energy, energy consultancy based in Dubai, also formerly an executive at Shell. Robin, morning.
Hello, good morning.
What stood out to you then in this?
Well, it's a strong set of results. I think that's not surprising, given the rise in oil and gas prices, obviously, and they even beating expectations, though. It's obviously notable that the gas sales were down because Shell, of course, was hit by the attacks in the Middle East, particularly on its facilities in Qatar. So, again, I think that was expected, but interesting to have the exact quantification of those losses, which were quite significant.
Yeah, and there wasn't really a sense of a timeline of when that would be 100% up and running again, was there? From what I could see quickly in the numbers, anyway.
No, not yet. I mean, there's obviously a projection for the production in the second quarter, which is substantially down. So that at least tells you that they're not seeing any recovery over the next quarter.
And in terms of also, there's been an announcement of a purchase of a Canadian company as well, ARC Resources. Is that significant?
Oh, well, very much so. Yeah, $14 billion deal, which is going through now. Shell just recently started up its LNG, liquefied natural gas export project from Canada. So this ARC Resources will help to supply gas to that and build their position in Canada. So, a pretty significant move.
I suppose it's going to be a question for the entire sector now, isn't it? We've seen bumper profits from other multinationals too, haven't we? Equinor and the Americans as well. Whether there will be questions in Europe once again about so-called windfall taxes on what are seen as excess profits that have come about as a result of the war?
No doubt there will be. I mean, I'd note that the European companies so far have done rather actually better than the Americans, which is kind of interesting. But there will be a call for windfall taxes. But, you know, most of these profits are not being made from assets in Europe, in the UK or elsewhere in Europe. I mean, they're being made from other places. And as we say, they're also offset, of course, by the losses in production related to the war.
And what does it tell you then going forward, Shell's strategy ahead?
Well, I think this will be positively received for the CEO, for Wael Sawan, an endorsement of his strategy so far. Decent beating of expectations and strong results overall. Okay, I think he can't do much about the war, But other than that, looking good. And I think the as we said, the acquisition of ARC Resources is another pretty big strategic move in strengthening Shell's position in gas.
Robin, thanks as always for your time. Robin Mills there, the Chief Executive of Camar Energy.
Well, thank you. 70 minutes past seven. There was a very bracing piece of news yesterday for the jobs market, particularly for young people with degrees. The jobs site Adzuna suggesting that graduate vacancies were down by a third in the last year. Others, though, saying the march of AI will eventually mean different jobs, not fewer jobs. Let us talk to Steve Hyde, who's the co-founder of Push, which is an AI-led marketing company, and to Professor Gina Neff, who's Professor of Responsible AI at Queen Mary's University, London. Deputy CEO as well of Responsible AI UK. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Give us the picture, Steve, from your company when it comes to the hiring of people out of university.
Well, it's definitely changed, and I would certainly see that we're seeing a reshaping of roles rather than a complete replacement of roles. So in some ways, it's similar to the pattern we saw when the internet kind of really impacted on business, in the sense that there was a lot of disruption then. But what we're starting to see is a very different kind of graduate requirement. So typically we're looking for graduates that are very adaptable, that are AI curious or just curious in general. But I think there is some optimism for graduates going forward, because I think they come now with the impact that AI is beginning to have on business. It's very, very big, and it's happening very fast. But what businesses typically need, they need a fresh perspective, fresh thinking. So there is some optimism for graduates, but they certainly need to be prepared and AI ready, rather than ignoring the impact that AI will have on their careers.
Professor Neff, what would you add to that?
Yes, we still don't fully understand the AI's impact on jobs. Stanford economists recently called young workers canaries in the coal mine. And other economists are a little more sanguine about the data. This report that was released today shows what UK employers are saying, people like Steve. And that's really important. It's a data point that we're not hearing from. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that, you know, employers are facing a lot of different changes right now. It's not just the transition to AI. There's slow growth in the UK. There's the worries about inflation and the economic outlook. I think employers need to think about how they're going to capture the gains from AI to really improve the products and services that they sell to customers and clients. And that opens up, ironically, a huge opportunity for young workers. They have the opportunity to jump on the fast elevator to the second floor of their careers.
Yeah. I mean, and in that way, and I suppose AI does this in a wider sense as well, Steve, it favors those who are, in a sense, the more able, who are the more adaptable at any rate, and able to kind of insert themselves into this world. And it doesn't favour those who are not able to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a new cliche that you'll hear bounded around, but we're starting now to look for new employees that are AI native. And we used to talk about the term digital native. So, you know, typically, if we are looking to hire, we won't be looking out in the market at perhaps a 28 or a 30-year-old that's got 6 or 7 years marketing experience. We're more likely to take on someone that is fresh. So we've recently taken on someone, for example, who was a student at Exeter University and did a degree in philosophy. A few years ago, perhaps 10 years ago, we'd be looking at maths graduates, business graduates, and economics graduates, but now it's really changing. And
that's really interesting. Right. So what does the philosopher, what does he or she bring that the maths graduate doesn't?
I think it brings a ton of curiosity and open-mindedness. Adaptability, I think, is really important. And this particular person showed us even before, I mean, he used AI to kind of hunt down the kind of companies that he thought would be appropriate. He sent loads of direct emails to company founders, and he showed and demonstrated that he was very, very AI curious and using tools, not just in his career, but also in his personal life and the way that he was managing himself.
And the risk, Professor Neff, for companies who don't
hire in that manner and hire the kind of people who fit into this world, effectively, there's going to be no one left to be senior in the years to come, is there? I mean, you think of law firms, etc., where, yes, quite a few of the tasks that might be done by juniors can be done pretty much by machines, as it were, now. But actually, you leave yourself open to quite a crisis in a few years' time.
That's absolutely right. We need to create good job ladders so people can come into organizations and move their way through. I think that this point that's been made, that being creative and flexible, being able to communicate with people and work well in teams, those are skills that are going to be pretty much AI proof. And being able to do those things plus know how to use AI responsibly and well is really what's going to differentiate people. I think one of the challenges is young people are being told, do not use these products in school and training. But then they get into the workplace and they think they're employers are being, I expect them to use them. And so we have to have a better conversation about upskilling and reskilling so that people can be ready for this transition.
That's interesting, isn't it, Steve Hyde? I mean, obviously your Exeter student was using AI, though presumably not in an illegal way at Exeter. But there is some worry attached to it for pretty obvious reasons, isn't there, at universities? And they've got to find a way around that as well.
It is polarized. You're seeing there are some students that are very anti-AI for lots of different reasons. But my message to every parent out there of a graduate and all the graduates is you know, embrace it, get on top, start getting involved. You're right. It's absolutely polarized. And I think universities have got a responsibility to really think about the future of their graduates' careers.
Mm. Okay, Steve Hyde, co-founder of Push, which is an AI-led marketing company, and Professor Gina Neff, who's Professor of Responsible AI at Queen Mary's London. Thank you both very much.
It's coming up to 24 minutes past seven. This week on the programme, we are celebrating the incredible life of Sir David Attenborough. In the lead up to the day, he turns 100 years old, and we're hearing reflections from well-known friends and fans of his work. And we're taking the opportunity to listen back to some great moments from his extensive broadcasting career. Here's Michaela Strachan, naturalist and TV presenter, sharing her thoughts on Sir David.
I think one of my favourite moments from any of David's programmes that he's done is in The Life of Birds, when he met the lyrebird. And it's a beautiful bird with a unique, elaborate and complex song. And it's a bird that is a brilliant mimic. And in the piece, you hear it copy a kookaburra, a camera shutter, a car alarm and a chainsaw.
He also, in his attempt to outsing his rivals, incorporates other sounds that he hears in the forest. That was a camera shutter. And again. And now a camera with a motor drive. And that's a car alarm. And now, the sounds of foresters and their chainsaws working nearby.
And for me, that symbolises David's life. He inspired us with the beauty of wildlife. The camera shutter is very symbolic of his work. You know, he spent his life filming. And then the car alarm and the chainsaw shows the fragility and destruction of the natural world. And so this clip went from beauty to a signal of destruction. And I think that's why that clip has stayed with me for so long. I think anyone that's into wildlife, David is right up there as the most iconic wildlife presenter, and he's influenced so many of us and inspired so many of us. But, you know, it's not just the fact that he's inspired us to love wildlife and appreciate it. He's inspired me to grow old gracefully. Here's a man that is still so incredible in his 90s, reaching 100 now. When David does a program, when he puts his name on any natural history program, it is like putting a real stamp on it. You know that it's going to be good. And for me, particularly in his latter life, it's his voiceovers that are still so incredible. His voice melts into the pictures. And I've often listened to his voice and tried to learn from it as a wildlife presenter myself and someone that does voiceovers. He's an inspiration and he's adored by all the different generations. I don't think there's anybody that doesn't like David. Everybody loves him.
How lovely to hear that, Michaela Strachan there. And can I suggest that you dip into BBC Sounds because you'll find rare radio clips from across 7 decades of David Attenborough's life on the BBC. A lot of those you won't hear anywhere else. You've got stories of family, childhood, music and his career. And you've got classic tales of his travels all around the world. It's enchanting.
27 minutes past seven. To Mike and the sport.
I think one of the most remarkable bits of television I've ever seen is Sir David Attenborough with a baby rhino. If you've ever seen it, you can still find it on social media. He's in his 80s, I think, when he did this. And it was a baby, orphan baby rhino who was blind. And Sir David gets on his hands and knees next to the rhino and communicates with the rhino. It's at the end of, I think, his Africa series. It's just a remarkable bit of television. And yeah, it's an inspiring piece you can still find online. We are talking football this morning because Chelsea's 6-year dominance of the Women's Super League is over. Manchester City are the new WSL champions. They won the title last night without even kicking a ball after the only team that could catch them at the top, Arsenal, were held to a 1-1 draw at Brighton. It is Manchester City's first Women's Super League title for 10 years, and we will have more on this story in the next hour of the programme. Next, to the Men's Champions League.
And it's all over in Munich, and the 2026 Champions League final is going to be Arsenal against PSG, because the holders are going to get the chance to go back to back in this competition. They have beaten Bayern Munich in an epic 11-goal semi-final that finishes on aggregate Bayern Munich 5, Paris Saint-Germain 6, and the French celebrations are going to go long and loud into the night.
Yes, Paris Saint-Germain, the defending champions, emerged victorious from their semi-final second leg with Bayern Munich last night, drawing 1-1 on the night in Munich, and as you heard, winning the tie 6-5 on aggregates. Well, you heard commentator Conor McNamara there. He was describing the action last night inside the Allianz Arena. Joins us live on the programme now from Munich. Morning, Conor.
Good morning, Mike.
So not quite the goal fest of the first leg, but still an enthralling second leg last night.
Yeah, a game of the highest quality. You just know that Mikel Arteta and his Arsenal players will have been looking on last night to see who they're going to face, and they'll have felt that either of these teams are of the highest calibre. The significance of the early goal last night was huge. So one goal between them. Paris Saint-Germain had the advantage from the first leg, and they scored first. So suddenly they've got a 2-goal lead. Ousmane Dembele scoring after 2 minutes and 19 seconds. And that just heaped extra pressure. I think doubled the pressure on Vincent Kompany's Bayern Munich. Yes, they had the home advantage. Great atmosphere in the Allianz last night. But because they knew they needed to, suddenly they had to push and force everything. Their front three, all former Premier League players, Michael Olise, Harry Kane, Luis Diaz, they've scored over 100 goals between them this season. But they struggled to get going because despite loads of possession, the Paris Saint-Germain players very cleverly defended against them. Nuno Mendes was able to shut down Michael Olise mostly. Luis Diaz, who kept trying to burst into the penalty area, found himself being man-marked by Marquinhos, who's normally a central defender but sort of played on the right-hand side just to concentrate on neutering the presence of Luis Diaz. And because they cut those two down, it limited the supply line to Harry Kane. Kane only had one proper chance in the game. He scored it, but it was the 94th minute. It was simply too late on a night that Bayern needed to.
So that means, as you allude to, it will be Arsenal against Paris Saint-Germain in the final at the end of this month in Budapest, Saturday, the 30th of May. These two met in the semi-finals last year, didn't they? And this really is a marquee final for what is, you have to say, the biggest match in club football.
Yeah, absolutely huge. For this Paris Saint-Germain team, it's a chance to become back-to-back Champions League finals. I think the strategy, the transformation of that club, they've gone from the era when they spent loads of money having Neymar and the likes of Lionel Messi, and they've changed it, and they now have brought through so many of these exciting kids, many of them local Parisians who came through the youth system. Then they added in the little bit of firepower with the likes of Kvaratskhelia, who they signed from Napoli. He still wasn't a household name when they signed him, but it's a team now. It's not superstars, and that's a very potent weapon that Paris Saint-Germain have.
The countdown to the final is on, as we say. Saturday the 30th of May, Arsenal against Paris Saint-Germain in Budapest. Conor McNamara, many thanks for that this morning. Just to say, this evening, Aston Villa take on Nottingham Forest in the second leg of their Europa League semi-final. Forest leading by a goal to nil in that tie. Crystal Palace take on Shakhtar Donetsk in the second leg of their Conference League semi-final.
Thank you very much, Mike. Now, next week on Radio 4, a story of courage against ruthless smugglers.
2 years ago, we tracked down the head of one of the largest cross-channel people smuggling gangs. Now we want to unmask the man believed to control an entire network.
He threw the whole family in the water.
So a whole family died?
They did.
I'm Sue Mitchell, investigating with my friend Rob Laurie.
If I get the name, I know I can find him.
Our hunt takes us from the UK, across Europe, into the Middle East.
He's working between Libya and France.
And it will be dangerous.
Pop, 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 pop.
Very violent.
To Catch a King starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Wednesday morning at 9:30.
To the weather, mostly cloudy today, although parts of the east and the south will have sunny spells, especially this morning.
And coming up later in the programme, preparations are underway in Moscow for Victory Day. That's the parade marking the Soviet victory against the Nazis in World War II. But for the first time in two decades, there'll be no military hardware on display.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Katja Adler and Justin Webb. The time is 27 minutes to 8 and Jane Steele has the news.
Two British people have returned to the UK and are self-isolating in an undisclosed location after potential exposure to hantavirus on board a cruise ship. A British man has also been airlifted from the MV Hondius to receive specialist treatment in the Netherlands. Professor Robin May, the UK Health Security Agency's chief scientific officer, told this programme the risk to the wider public when passengers return would be really negligible and there should be no cause for concern. President Trump says he believes a deal with Iran is very possible, but threatened to again bomb the country if negotiations fell apart. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said Tehran would share its views of the latest US peace proposal with Pakistani mediators. The oil giant Shell has reported underlying earnings of just over £5 billion for the first 3 months of the year. That's more than double the previous quarter. Four women with links to the jihadist group Islamic State are due to arrive in Australia soon. They've said they just want their nine children to be safe. The group said they'd experienced hell while living in a detention camp in Syria for years. Australian police have warned that some of the women face possible arrest and charges. A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods. The investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct has been going on since January last year. The IOPC says it's linked to reports made by four victim survivors. Polling stations across Wales, Scotland and parts of England have opened for millions of people to cast their vote in elections. The first results are expected to come in the early hours of tomorrow morning.
Jane, thank you. 25 to 8 is the time. What on earth is going on with Iran and the US? So much of our immediate economic future depends on it. So much of the world's food security and energy security and general well-being depends on it, not to mention the safety of people in the Gulf states and in Iran itself. And yet there is, to put it mildly, some confusion about the status of negotiations between the two sides. Donald Trump has said various things, some positive, some negative. Most recently, he said great progress had been made towards a complete and final agreement. Darren Selnick was Deputy Chief of Staff at the Department of War, working directly under the War Secretary, as he styles himself, Pete Hegseth. He's been telling me what he thinks is happening.
So there are negotiations going on. Meanwhile, the military is on alert at all times to see if Iran is going to officially break the ceasefire, block the Strait of Hormuz, and they're at the ready. So if the president changes his mind, if the talks do not go successfully, the president is serious. He will call in military strikes. He has a number of options that the Pentagon has given him, Secretary Hegseth and General Kane. So he's very serious. He needs to get this effort done. He needs to get the strait open. He needs to get negotiations over. And he's not going to be misled or put in a position where it won't be successful.
What's your understanding, though, at the moment of why the strait isn't open?
The Iranians are playing, my personal opinion, playing a game in terms of thinking they can get negotiating points by closing the strait and still keep their nuclear materials.
That's a successful game, isn't it?
They think it might be. In the end, it won't. The president won't allow that. And as long as he thinks negotiations are concluding in a way that will end his red line of eliminating all nuclear materials and opening the strait, he will keep the stranglehold of the blockade on, and he will ramp up force as necessary if the negotiations are not going in a timely manner.
What do you think the bottom line is? What is it that Donald Trump needs to get from Iran in terms of firm agreements in order for a proper de-escalation?
I think what he has to have, his absolute red line, is going to be the elimination of all the nuclear material. And a set agreement in terms of how many years, 10, 15, 20 years, that there will be no more enrichment, and that what that enrichment will be and the proper way of getting that material out and ensuring it. So he does not want a deal where he makes a deal, but they renege on the deal, and there is no trust with the Iranian regime. He has to have that. He has to have the strait clear and open at all times. That's the two absolute red lines. There'll be other negotiated points in terms of proxies in Lebanon and those sorts of things, but those are two absolute. He will not finish the job here without all the Iranian nuclear materials gone, and an agreement in terms of how many years.
And that would not allow any enrichment at all, because, of course, they did have the right to enrich, didn't they, to a certain amount. Are you saying,
right,
in your view, there will be no right at all for any enrichment?
I think the news reports are correct that we're seeing no enrichment for a particular amount of time, probably about 15 years or so. I think that's what's negotiating. And then after that point, a very, very small amount of enrichment that corresponds with what a normal enrichment process would be if you're just going to do nuclear power.
And finally, regime change? What's happened to that?
I think they want regime change, but they're not going to go in with 50,000 troops and do it themselves. I think reports that we're hearing are correct, that the CIA and others are trying to find the best way to arm the civilian population and let the civilian population do its own regime change. Once the bombing stopped, the negotiations have happened. The country is in crisis with the blockade and everything else. It was already in crisis before. And I think the population is ready for regime change, but it's going to be up to the population to do it. But of course, you can't do it with sticks and stones. You need guns. So I think they'll be arming them covertly through whatever means possible. And they will be letting the civilian population, the military units that may decide to join in, but they've got to do it themselves.
That was Darren Selnick, former Deputy Chief of Staff at the Department of War in the US. What then would the Iranians accept when it comes to these potential compromises? I've been talking to Sassan Karimi, who's a former Iranian Deputy Vice President for Strategic Affairs, now a Professor of Global Studies at the University of Tehran. Asked if the regime would accept a time-limited deal on the right to enrich uranium.
It depends if, in return, the United States, for example, remove all the sanctions, at least secondary sanctions and the international sanctions, and eliminates permanently all the UN, United Nations Security Council resolutions, then maybe the administration can sell it to the people on the streets. But if we just sign or accept such a term with 10 years or 12 years with not a significant return, then it will look like a surrender, which does not mean that much because we actually defended ourselves and the country for 40 days and 12 days not to be surrendered.
What about the Strait of Hormuz? Do you think it is feasible that Iran says, OK, on the Strait of Hormuz, we accept now, everyone can use it again and we will not interfere?
I think it is possible, but Iran's consideration is to just let the commercial vessels pass and not the military vessels. And it has enough arguments because the military vessels are threatening Iran's potentially, according to a couple of wars, and security of the passage and the maritime in this strait and also the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea can be provided easily by Iran, and there is no need for example, American navies.
We just heard a former deputy chief of staff under Pete Hegseth at the American Department of War saying that he thought the CIA would start to arm people inside Iran in order that in the longer term the regime falls. When you hear that kind of thing, what goes through your mind?
If the macro elements get resolved, or at least a kind of non-aggression pact should be started, if it started, then the micro policies like this would be smoothest. And, you know, I don't believe that much in such callings for the citizens or threatening against arresting the citizens of each other. So I don't think that they are that much meaningful at the time.
But that's interesting. You think that the regime in Iran, that those who are currently in charge in Iran will feel that if there is a deal, then they are safe.
The political system and also the people are in charge do not that much care about such a safety, you know, for their lives or whatever. And they showed that their own life is the last priority for the Islamic Republic people. So I don't think they want to provide any kind of safety, even for the political system. But they want to go forward with a prestigious way to stabilize the peace and to have a guarantee, and not a guarantee actually, but a semi-guarantee for a non-aggression mutually. But still, they know that the United States can break it up. Also, Israel will have whatever it can to destruct any kind of peace in this region.
Sassan Karimi, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And it's just gone 17 minutes to 8.
What do we need to thrive? How can we understand the inner landscape of our bodies, in particular our immune systems, and how they interact with our brains? There is a new book. It is called Organs Speak, and in it, Julia Enders explores the incredible biology at work every day in our brains and our guts as well, and how it can affect some of our most basic needs, like the need for sleep.
Well, the thing about sleep is that it's different brain parts having to really cooperate with each other, where when we usually are up and running, we have this frontal part of the brain that deals with all the responsibilities and awake life. But when you go to sleep, it actually has to like pass it on to other areas that are good at regulating, balancing the body, doing other things. And sometimes those two parts are not getting along so well because they are dealing with very different lives. This modern life is really different, you know, to what's going on inside of us. And so some people might have a hard time falling asleep, especially in times when there's all these news and things bombarded at us that give our brain like general feeling of, oh, maybe it's safer to just have a very light sleep in case something happens. Because some areas of the brain, they cannot decide whether this is an actual imminent threat.
On behalf of your brain, can you do the deciding?
Well, this is what people like to think. But it can't just tell the other brain parts what to do, and can't just tell it to fall asleep, because it's a relationship and they notice how it's, you know, going about things.
Because the practical advice we give ourselves now is don't look, for instance, at your phone just before you want to go to sleep. And that's a fairly obvious thing, isn't it? And lots of people do it, and some people don't do it and cope with the consequences of it. Beyond that, are there other things that we should be doing in our daily lives?
the general understanding that these lower parts of the brain have to really get the feeling that it's okay to take over, to put us to deep sleep. This is the basis and foundation of all of these to-do things. Don't use your phone, don't eat too late, don't have too like exciting meetings in the end of the day, don't get riled up by the news too late. Maybe write down all of your worries, some doctors will say, and all the things that you're thinking about, what you have to do. So write them down so you get to them in the morning, you promise yourself. But then your brain gets this sense of, now it's actually okay to, take another route, do something very else than just being busy with the outside world.
It's all of this is in the context of the wider point you're making in your book, which I suppose isn't necessarily a new point, is it? But it is something that we have to remind ourselves, which is that our bodies are complex, and understanding them, or almost being sympathetic with them, I suppose, is good for us.
That is good for us, but it's also really about seeing them in a smarter, more, maybe, let's say, modern way. Because a lot of the common knowledge we have about our bodies is from old research from the 30s, 50s. And we have it now, but there's so much more and so much more differentiated knowledge that makes us think differently about not only sleep, but the immune system, the way strength works in the body and achievement works. And oftentimes I think we apply those old imagery of the body to also societal things, like what is strength, a human achieving much in their work and pushing a lot of workload, carrying a lot or moving forward fast. But in the body, it's different things as well. And it's interesting to see these aspects in a bodily light or get some inspiration from there to see where maybe we have ignored some aspects.
Give us an example.
Well, for example, with immunity, I think now, and that's very a present topic, right? Mm. Safety. We keep thinking the immune system, and we've heard this all along the pandemic too, that it's all about fending off the bat, attacking the bat, hitting the bat. And that is one aspect of immunity, especially and intensively researched during a time where we had the world wars going on, which, formed a lot of the language we use, killer cells, barrier, attacking, and so on. But since the 90s, at least, we know with the danger hypothesis and other things that it's not only about that. Safety in a body is generated through cooperating with good microbes. We know this through the microbiome. It's also continually building tolerance towards things that aren't that bad. So, self-knowledge, cooperation, and tolerance are just equally as important in a well-balanced immune system.
The book is called Organs Speak. Julia Enders, thank you.
Thank you.
It's coming up to 12 minutes to 8. And it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields.
Good morning. It looks like the Dutch cruise ship facing an onboard virus outbreak is heading for safe harbour in the Canary Islands after Cape Verde explained it didn't have the facilities to cope. One can only imagine the anxiety of passengers and crew with lives lost and others gravely ill. A ship that was supposed to offer a relaxing escape has turned into a nightmarish prison. As an inexperienced sailor, my assumption boarding a boat is that all the danger comes from the outside with rearing waves, howling gales and unpredictable storms. I turn to my companions to respond to every challenge and keep me safe. But in this case, the peril lies on board the boat itself as a predatory virus seeks its next victim. The other passengers and crew turn from cherished colleagues to potential threats. Noah's Ark was not originally a children's story. It perceives the world as mired in folly and catastrophe. The only route is to escape and begin again. The Mayflower did the same when the Pilgrim Fathers left behind benighted Europe and set sail to the New World to make a righteous commonwealth in 1620. But that approach doesn't work if the problem lies not on shore but on board. I see the cruise ship as a metaphor for planet Earth. It's easy to assume all dangers lie outside and beyond, but in fact, on the Earth's risk register, hardly anything besides the odd meteor poses any kind of a threat. All the dangers, war, climate change, famine, disease, perhaps AI, lie on board ship. Our challenge as Earthlings lies in sharing the planet with one another. The threat lies not externally, but among and within ourselves. The Christian faith is simply that in Jesus, God didn't avoid the ship in peril, but aware of the virus and its menace, came on board and shared the danger, becoming one of the casualties and yet transcended that plight, and provided a way for passengers and crew to find freedom and safety. One question that arises when one sees the cruise ship as a metaphor for our planet is this: if the Earth in peril applied to other planets for permission to dock at, say, Mercury or Mars, would such authorization be granted? Or would it, like the Dutch liner, be considered too dangerous to be associated with? I find myself wondering, were I a resident of Venus, would I actually welcome planet Earth coming into harbour and potentially spreading its virus of enmity, pollution and violence? Might a close relationship with humankind prove more trouble than it was worth?
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells. It brings us to 10 to 8.
In Moscow, preparations are very much underway for the Victory Day parade, marking the Soviet victory against the Nazis in World War II. For the first time in two decades, though, there'll be a conspicuous absence at the parade: military hardware. And why? Well, because of fears of a long-range attack by Ukrainian drones. Yesterday, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova issued a warning to diplomatic staff and civilians in Kyiv should Ukraine choose to strike on Victory Day.
The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs strongly urges the authorities of your country, the management of your organization, to treat this statement with the utmost responsibility and to ensure the timely evacuation of personnel of diplomatic and other representative offices, as well as citizens from the city of Kyiv.
Well, Steve Rosenberg joins me now from Moscow. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Katya.
Moscow has warned of a massive missile strike on central Kyiv if a unilateral ceasefire that it's declared for Victory Day is violated. How worried is Vladimir Putin? I mean, no military hardware at the parade seems quite extreme.
There is a definite nervousness, a sense of anxiety here, I think, ahead of Victory Day on Saturday. I mean, the authorities clearly concerned that Ukraine could target the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow. There are these fears of drones flying over Red Square attacking. And I think Vladimir Putin's decision to announce that ceasefire is widely interpreted as an attempt to try and head off any threat to the Moscow parade. And just in case, as you mentioned, you know, Moscow's warned Kyiv of this massive retaliatory response if Ukraine tries to target the Victory Day celebrations. But the fact that the parade is being scaled back and that there'll be no military hardware, no tanks and no missiles, that is a big deal. Because under Vladimir Putin, the Soviet victory in World War II has been chosen as the foundation stone, if you like, of Russia's national identity. And the annual Victory Day parade, you know, normally showcasing all the latest Russian military hardware, has been used by the Kremlin in previous years to sort of project Russian military power to the world. So scaling back the parade is not something the Kremlin will have been keen to do.
And what does it make Russians think about Vladimir Putin? Do they think that makes Vladimir Putin look weak, on the back foot?
I was asking people on the streets, actually, yesterday, what their reaction was. And one person said to me, well, you know, it's a great shame because the parade, the military hardware, the tanks, this projects our power to the world, and perhaps we should have put something on display. Someone else said to me, well, I can understand that in the current security circumstances, maybe it's not a good idea to put out the tanks. But on the other hand, people think that we're frightened of something, and that's not a good look too. So it hasn't gone unnoticed by the population.
Mm. And there's a sense, isn't there? I mean, I don't know how reliable you think there are, but there are polls in Russia, and those polls are indicating that people are becoming increasingly unhappy with their government and with Vladimir Putin specifically.
I think we've entered a very interesting period now in Russia. From what we can see, certainly President Putin seems to be making fewer public appearances, making fewer trips. I don't get the impression that he's sitting in a bunker somewhere for weeks on end, not emerging. But one thing has changed. I remember, you know, towards the end of last year, on several occasions, Vladimir Putin was shown on state television in military fatigues, visiting command posts, oozing confidence, you know, as he spoke to his generals about reported Russian success in the war in Ukraine. We haven't seen this kind of commander-in-chief Putin on television for some time now. And now the war is in its fifth year, and Russia's struggling to prevent Ukrainian drone attacks on many different Russian regions. And at the same time, yes, polling even by state-run pollsters, has shown that over the last couple of months, Vladimir Putin's domestic approval rating has been declining. And it's not so much the figures themselves that we should latch onto, it's the general trend downwards. And I think that does reflect a kind of, well, growing discontent in the country, a sort of mixture, fatigue with the war, concern about the economy, and Russians definitely feeling the pinch, you know, after 4 years of sanctions. And there's a lot of irritation with the sort of state-imposed restrictions on the internet. And that has come together, and I think that's affected his rating.
And that's been stepped up, hasn't it, particularly now before Victory Day, citing threats of drone attacks. But I was just wondering, Steve, what's your sense? Is Vladimir Putin's position in danger then? I mean, not just from Ukraine drone attack, but actually at home. Is it dissatisfaction, or is it actually, yeah, a threat to his position?
I mean, to every action, there is a reaction, right? That's not just the law of physics. It's the law of politics too, isn't it? So when Vladimir Putin launched that full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, I think he set in motion processes inside his own country that have become more apparent the longer the war's gone on. Call it what you will, a sort of an imbalance of the system, a destabilization of the system, a shifting of the tectonic plates on which the Putin system is based. But objectively, we are seeing things now that we didn't see a few months back, right? We're seeing stinging public criticism of the authorities and in a limited number of cases of President Putin himself. And we're seeing certain newspapers in a very controlled media environment, right, in Russia, certain newspapers being heavily critical of the security forces for turning the screws of repression, for imposing restrictions on the internet. To me, that suggests that there are people, groups in power, who want this criticism to get out and be made public. And that also suggests that there are competing factions, right, in the corridors of power. It doesn't mean the Putin system is on the point of collapse. It does mean, though, that the system becomes harder to manage, I think, on a daily basis, especially when you're in the fifth year of a war which hasn't gone to plan, and with economic, you know, pressures from that war, from sanctions building up. So I think the question is now, how will Putin deal with these systemic challenges that have built up?
Fascinating. Thank you very much, Steve Rosenberg in Moscow.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Arrived late for your favourite programme? Did you know that most smart speakers can start the programme again?
Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart and listen from the beginning.
Hello, I am Andy Zaltzman. Welcome to the news quiz.
Disclaimer, restart function is not able to restart your entire life or the history of the universe.
Try it for yourself. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart.
8:02 and time for the weather forecast with Darren Bett.
Thanks very much, Katya. Average sort of weather really today. Average temperatures for this time of the year and a mixture of sunshine but also some showers. Now, there is a fairly weak weather front that's approaching the northwest of Scotland today. It's going to bring with it a band of thicker cloud and some patchy rain and pick the breeze up here. The rest of Scotland seeing some sunny intervals and some showers developing as well. And it's a similar story for Northern Ireland too. England and Wales seeing some sunshine here and there during the morning. More cloud develops though as we head into the afternoon as temperatures rise a bit, and that's going to lead to a few showers, mainly across western parts of England and Wales. The odd light one is possible across the southeast of England that will push into East Anglia. So the best of the weather, central southern England through the Midlands towards Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and that's where we're seeing the best of the sunshine during this morning. But we've got a southerly breeze today, still quite gentle away from the northwest of Scotland, but it means that temperatures will be a little bit higher generally than yesterday, and typically 14 to 16 degrees. So that's average for this time of the year. During this evening and overnight, there'll be a few breaks in the cloud. There'll be more showers, though, for England and Wales. And this band of patchy rain and light rain heads southeastwards across Scotland. Minimums will be 4 to 6 degrees. Scotland and Northern Ireland looking quite cloudy, but with fewer showers tomorrow. A bit cooler, though, 12 degrees. Sunshine and showers for England and Wales tomorrow, but warmer, particularly in the southeast of England, where temperatures could be approaching a 19, possibly even a very pleasant 20 Celsius.
Darren, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katya Adler and Justin Webb.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 7th of May. Good morning. The headlines this morning: Health officials have said the wider risk to the public from the virus on a cruise ship is very low after it emerged that two British people who'd been on board the ship are now self-isolating back in the UK. President Trump has predicted that America's war with Iran will be over quickly, but Iranian officials have been less optimistic about a peace deal. And a serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed were handled while he was alive. We'll speak to a survivor of Fayed's abuse at 8:30.
And also in today's programme, we'll hear from the boss of the National Cybersecurity Centre on a perfect storm of rapid technological change and rising geopolitical tension. We'll hear about that just after the news. Plus, the author Robert McFarlane, the illustrator Jackie Morris on their new production, The Book of Birds, A Field Guide to Wonder and Loss. And President Obama says he's confident there aren't any little green men or alien spacecraft being hidden in government facilities because they wouldn't have been able to keep it secret.
Some guy guarding the installation would have taken a selfie with one of the aliens and sent it to his girlfriend and press him. It would leak.
We'll be asking, what is it about America and the fascination there with UFOs? The news is read this morning by Jane Steele.
The UK Health Security Agency says the risk to the public from hantavirus remains very low after revealing two British people on board the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak have returned home. The pair are now self-isolating. Their exact location has not been disclosed. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The British pair left the cruise ship at the island of St Helena and flew back to the UK via Johannesburg. They didn't have symptoms but contacted health officials when they heard of the hantavirus cases on the ship. In cooperation with international health authorities, contacts on their journey home are being traced. The UK HSA also said British people currently on the ship would be flown back to the UK on a charter flight, probably from the Canary Islands, as long as they don't have symptoms. They would then have to self-isolate or be put into quarantine, possibly for up to 6 weeks, depending on the timing of their last potential exposure to the virus. The authorities are working out how this will be implemented. The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public is low and the virus rarely spreads through human-to-human transmission and only after close contact.
Professor Robin May, the Chief Scientific Officer at the UK HSA, told us efforts are underway to try to control any spread of the virus.
We have big teams who do contact tracing, and we have a pretty robust system, actually, that really looks in detail at the particular disease and the particular transmission patterns. So for hantavirus, this is actually not that easy to transmit between individuals. So a quick pass in an airport, for example, is not going to put you at risk. We focus our attention on people who might, for example, have been sat next to a passenger for a long time, several hours on a flight.
A British man is receiving specialist treatment in the Netherlands after being airlifted from the ship. He's been widely named as 56-year-old Martin Anstey and had been working as an expedition guide. He has told Sky News that he is in isolation and has no idea how long he'll be in hospital. The BBC hasn't spoken to him. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek reports from the Dutch city of Leiden.
Here at the University Medical Centre, specialists have been treating the patient who's thought to be Mr. Anstey. His condition is said to be stable after previously being described as critical. A 65-year-old German woman was also flown into Amsterdam last night and has been taken to Dusseldorf for treatment. A second emergency flight, carrying a third person airlifted from the Hondius yesterday, is expected to land in the Netherlands later. The remaining 146 passengers on board are now finally heading for Tenerife on what is expected to be a three-day journey, barring any further problems. The Spanish Health Ministry says no one on the ship has any symptoms of hantavirus.
President Trump has predicted that the war in Iran will be over quickly and has claimed that most people understand his goal of ending Tehran's nuclear ambitions. A US media report has suggested that the White House believes it could be close to agreeing a 14-point memo, which could set a framework for more detailed nuclear negotiations. Iran has yet to respond publicly to the latest American proposals. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Speaking during a virtual campaign event, President Trump told Republicans in the state of Georgia he was optimistic that the war would soon end. He added that most people understood he was right to deny Iran the opportunity to have a nuclear weapon. Speaking earlier at the White House, he insisted that Iran wanted to make a deal and that any hardship caused to Americans because of high fuel prices would be short-term. The US news outlet Axios has reported that a one-page, 14-point memo could form the basis of a final agreement, although a senior member of Iran's parliament has dismissed it as a wish list. Its contents have not been made public. Tehran said it would soon share its views on Washington's latest proposal with mediators in Pakistan.
The energy giant Shell has reported a higher-than-forecast surge in profits for the first quarter as the war in the Middle East sent oil and gas prices soaring. Underlying earnings were just over £5 billion. That's 24% higher than a year ago. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Shell has unsurprisingly seen its profits rise along with the price of oil and gas, and these results include only 1 month, March, of the conflict in the Gulf, which propelled oil prices from around $70 a barrel to 100 and beyond. Damage to some of its facilities in Qatar saw total oil and gas production volumes decline by 4% compared to the previous 3 months, and that damage is expected to hit gas production for the rest of this year. However, higher overall profits allowed the company to raise its dividend by 5%, and last year Shell paid £7 billion in dividends, nearly 10% of all payouts by companies in the FTSE 100.
A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct over the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods. The investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct has been going on since January last year. Mohammed Al-Fayed died in 2023, having never faced any charges. Here's our correspondent Ellie Price.
It was only after the BBC documentary in September 2024, which exposed just some of the sexual abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed, that the Met revealed it had been approached by 21 women before his death in 2023. Hundreds of women have since accused the former Harrods owner of rape, sexual assault and trafficking. The IOPC said it was yet to decide whether any current or former officers have, or would have had if they were still serving, a disciplinary case to answer. It's understood the serving officer is not on restricted duties. A Met Police spokesperson said the force was assisting the IOPC, adding the investigation of the officers did not mean that misconduct proceedings would necessarily follow.
Voting is underway at polling stations for elections in England, Scotland and Wales. The first results are expected to come in the early hours of tomorrow morning. Others won't be declared until the weekend. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
Across Great Britain, millions of voters will be electing their representatives today. In Scotland, 129 members of the Scottish Parliament will be chosen using a mixture of first-past-the-post constituencies and regional lists based on a system of proportional representation. In Wales, an enlarged 96-member Senedd will be elected from 16 large constituencies, all using PR. And in England, thousands of councillors and six mayors are being chosen as well. Polling stations will be open until 10 p.m. for registered voters who are over 18 in England or 16 in Scotland and Wales. Photo ID will be required to vote in person in England, but not in Scotland or Wales today. The results will start to come in overnight, but many areas won't begin counting until tomorrow, with some results as late as Saturday.
The Advertising Standards Authority is taking action after a BBC investigation found AI-generated characters making false and misleading claims about fitness workouts on social media. These included promises of dramatic body transformations, such as lose 40 pounds in a month and look 20 years younger in weeks. Disclaimers stating the adverts used artificial intelligence were also obscured or missing. The companies behind the ads have declined to comment. Amazon has become the first retailer in the UK to offer a drone delivery service. The Civil Aviation Authority has given approval for a limited trial in Darlington in County Durham. Here's our business correspondent Emma Simpson.
Darlington is the first place outside the US where Amazon is using drones for some deliveries. Eligible customers within a 7.5 mile radius can order and receive their shopping within 2 hours, as long as the parcel is the size of a shoebox and weighs less than £5. Items include everyday essentials such as toiletries and washing up liquid, to beauty products and batteries. A garden or yard is needed for the drop-off. The drone has sophisticated sensors to avoid and detect obstacles in its path, and with the help of GPS, knows exactly where to drop the parcel from 12 feet above the ground. There'll be only up to 100 deliveries per day during the week for now, but Amazon wants to slowly expand the service when regulations allow.
Emma Simpson reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. The president of the Atlantic Council said recently that Mythos, not the Iran war, is the most significant geopolitical warning of our time. Mythos is a new part of the Claude AI tool that busts through vulnerable security systems by finding dormant bugs and exploiting them. And Mythos has been joined in recent days by a rival owned by ChatGPT. How much cyber trouble, then, are we in? And what do we need to do to protect ourselves? The damage already being done is, of course, huge. Billions of pounds of cost and massive inconvenience, and indeed worse, affecting shops, businesses, but also hospitals. And of course, individuals, you probably use passwords to protect yourself online. So do people at the organisation you work for. So do people at other organisations you depend on. None of them should, according to the National Cyber Security Centre, the body set up to protect the nation from cyber attacks, saying pass keys, if they are offered, should now be used as the old methods don't work. And in a way, that, of course, is the underlying point. The old methods are quite often the methods that worked perfectly well until weeks ago, perhaps minutes ago. In the world of AI, the dangers are increasing and metastasizing at a rate that is troubling the experts, among them Dr. Richard Horn, who is the CEO of the National Cyber Security Center.
We are in a position where, as a nation, we're building ourselves on technology, and that technology is changing really fast. So we've got huge technology disruption. At the same time, we're in a world which is changing fast geopolitically, and there's rising tensions. And so we look at conflict zones, for example, and we see cyber attacks used as part of conflict to try and turn electricity off, to try and disrupt communications and so on. And so we as a nation need to focus on that intersection of these two forces where cybersecurity sits, how we secure ourselves as a nation. And that's our challenge today.
And when you talk about disruption, give us an example of the kind of disruption that we could see in the future. Because everyone's aware there has been already disruption and there'll be big companies that have been affected. But life goes on. You're suggesting it could get very tricky.
The challenge we face as a nation is that disruption can happen at scale. And what we're seeing with developments in technology, with some of the frontier AI developments, is we're seeing an ability for attackers to scale. And so it might not be one company that's hit by a cyber attack at a time in the future. It might be many at one time. So the scale of disruption can increase in the future, which is why we need all organisations to focus on their cybersecurity so that we're resilient against that kind of scenario.
So, for instance, the whole banking system. So you try to log into your bank, you can't, and the bank itself also can't work out what's going on. It's that kind of thing, is it? Or a hospital or a set of hospitals that are under attack and can't work out how to prevent it. That's the risk, is it, of what we're looking at?
So all organisations need to have a plan for if they're hit by a successful cyber attack, what they'll do to respond, how they'll continue operations and how they'll rebuild. So yes, that's absolutely something that all organisations need to be focused on. And the challenge we have as a nation is making sure that all organisations think about it, not just the big ones, not just the huge ones that know they're part of our critical national infrastructure and have a lot of regulation to encourage them and to focus on their cybersecurity, but all of us
need to
be focused on our cybersecurity.
We were talking earlier in the programme to the BBC's cybersecurity reporter, Joe Tidy, who was saying, basically, you're issuing pretty much the same warnings that have been issued for the best part of a decade. And I think his suggestion was that, well, we just sort of pooter on. But what you seem to be suggesting to me now is that because of the sophistication of the threats and because of the geopolitical situation, there is a very different, a new set of threats now and a much more damaging potentially set of threats now than there was, I don't know, a year, 2 years, 5 years ago. Is that right?
So absolutely, the threat environment is changing and we are more vulnerable today because of tools like the Frontier AI, tools that are coming out that will enable attackers to scale.
This is Mythos and things like Mythos.
Things like that, yep. And what that will enable is it will shine a light on where organisations haven't taken the fundamentals of cybersecurity seriously. So what we're saying today is it was urgent anyway, it's now 10 times more urgent.
So we do what?
So most important thing is for all organisations to focus on the fundamentals of cybersecurity. So we often talk about understand, defend, respond. Understand, so understand where you're running on old technology that can't be kept up to date and can't be have its vulnerabilities fixed. Understand the vulnerabilities in your supply chain that could come to bite you. Then defend, make sure you're applying security updates across your whole enterprise as much as possible. Make sure you've got the right defences in place. Make sure you're controlling who can log on where and things like that. And we often call them the cyber essentials. And there's a well-established scheme and guidance on our website and a whole ecosystem in the UK to help with that. And then really large organisations will need to do more. And then respond is the final bit. And that's where many organisations need the whole organisation to think about how would we continue operations if our IT was disrupted and how would we rebuild at scale if that scenario happened.
Are the AI companies, in your view, themselves behaving responsibly?
So the fact is that it's not just AI. Technology is racing at pace. And you know, how individual organisations are behaving is a matter for them. But for us as a society, we need to deal with this storm that is coming, where technology develops incredibly fast and changes the risk to us as a nation, and we need all organisations to focus on these fundamentals so that we can weather the storm.
And at the level of an individual, you've been saying interesting things, or the Cybersecurity Centre has been saying interesting things recently about passwords. Basically, passwords are now a thing of the past. Why, and what do people do instead?
So just as technology is enabling attackers, it can also enable us to make ourselves better defended. And one of the things that has changed over the last few years and is now being rolled out at scale is something called pass keys, which can be used to replace passwords. They're quicker, they're simpler, they're more secure than passwords. And we're really encouraging people to adopt pass keys, to use them when you get given the option by an app or a website, would you like to use a passkey? Say yes, because it's far more secure, it's simpler for you, and it's quicker, and it enables us to take out a whole load of attacks that we see that are often enabled by stealing passwords as the first step.
Right, so the stealing of passwords is now something that is regularly happening, because at one stage, of course, we were told passwords would keep us safe, but they just don't anymore, is what you're saying.
Well, passwords have been around for decades, and attackers have shaped their attacks to work out how to exploit weak passwords, how to exploit passwords that have been reused across multiple sites, and one of them might be breached. And so that gives them an opportunity to then get into other sites that have used those passwords. So they've been around for decades, and attackers have worked out how to steal them, how to pretend they're a website that they're not, or an app that they're not, to trick people into revealing them. So there are many attacks are enabled as the first step by some way of stealing a password. So we want to move society beyond that. The technology is giving us a really good solution. The big tech companies are rolling it out, and many providers of services online are now offering passkeys. So we really want to encourage individuals to take up the opportunity to use passkeys. If you're offered the opportunity, take it. If you go into security settings on many services you use, see if you can use a passkey and change your security settings to that. They will make you more secure, and they'll make us as a nation more secure.
Dr. Richard Horn, CEO of the National Cybersecurity Centre. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin.
It's 19 minutes past 8. Now, just a reminder that because of broadcasting rules, we can't talk about politics this morning because it is polling day across much of England and in Scotland and Wales for the devolved parliaments there. But there'll be a lot of politics tonight with Nick Robinson and Rachel Burden. They'll be bringing us results all night long on Radio 4 and then again in the morning. So it starts at 8 o'clock tonight. We'll have results and reaction on this programme here on the Today programme tomorrow morning. But just a warning, we won't have full results until the weekend. 19 minutes past eight. And I'm wondering, do you feel this spring that your mornings are just that little bit quieter? Now, you might not notice it if you live in the inner city with loads of traffic noise, but sadly, around 50% of bird species are in decline worldwide. And that means our dawns and springs are losing glorious song. Well, today sees the publication of a glorious new book, The Book of Birds, a field guide to wonder and loss. Those are some of the birds mentioned in the book that are in decline, including the nightingale and the cuckoo. Joining me now is the author of The Book of Birds, A Field Guide to Wonder and Loss, and Jackie Morris, illustrator of The Book of Birds. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Katya.
Good morning.
When I say it's glorious, and of course we hear the bird song there, obviously it's not cheerful about the loss, but the love comes through very, very strongly. Robert, you describe the book, which I have in front of me right now, it's glorious, is a love letter, don't you?
Yes, it is a love letter. We both grew up reading field guides, these wonderful, humble, undersung forms of literature, and that they helped us to see and hear birds early in our lives. And so we wanted to reimagine what a field guide to birds today in this age, as you say, of loss and endangerment, but still of absolute astonishment at their wonders would look like. And we sought to make it in paint, Jackie's extraordinary medium, and in language.
And we'll get to the extraordinary illustrations in just a second. But Robert, I find it interesting when you say that you want to identify with the birds. That's what you want us to do when we look at the book, not just identify them by sight.
Yeah. I think two differences. We ask at the beginning not what is that bird, but who is that bird? And then we ask readers to not just to identify birds, but to identify with them. And I mean, birds and humans have woven and stitched their lives into one another from the very beginning. I mean, some of the earliest art on the Chauvet cave walls is a long-eared owl painted with fingertips in the soft outer calcite of that cave wall. And so we are just the latest in a long line of people celebrating birds and wanting to recognize how they shape our languages, our memories, the stories we tell about ourselves to ourselves, and about ourselves and our relationship with the more than human world, the wider world, the wilder world.
And Jackie, the 300 new illustrations in your book, and you're exhibiting some of the originals at the moment, I think it's wonderful how you seem to want to enchant us into a love of birds, because I mean, I'm just looking at the Merlin. It's absolutely beautiful, but you show them, you kind of feel them. Many of the birds in the book, they're flying, so they're not the static images of sort of old field guides where birds seem to be facing all in the same direction.
Yes, what I always try to do when I'm painting is to try and capture something of the soul of the creature, and it is not just identifying with but trying to become bird. It's quite curious to see the paintings that I did in my studio now. They're in cases in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and just alongside the most exquisite things, including the work of Ferdinand Bauer, who has been a revelation to me. I didn't know about his work, but this is my family. You know, it stretches from the cave walls to everybody who's ever painted. And hopefully the book will go on to be a catalyst for awe and wonder for other creativity in other people, and also for hope and action.
Hope and action, yeah. And there is some good news, right? The birds here in Britain, birds are categorised according to green, amber or red, depending on how endangered they are. And the birds that you were depicting were amber and red. But I believe since you started writing the book, the kingfisher has gone green.
The kingfisher has gone green. Yeah, not in its plumage. It stays wondrous neon, blue and tangerine orange. But yes, there is good news. Birds show us how to hope. They help us hope. The red kite, as many people will know, has made an extraordinary comeback. The white-tailed eagle. Bitterns now boom inside the M25. And yes, the kingfisher has moved off. But of course, there's a transverse to that, which is that other birds have moved on to the red list now, which is now 70 species long. And when it was first drawn up by the BTO and the RSPB and others in 1996, it was 36 species long.
Well, I can highly recommend, I have the book in front of me, The Book of Birds. It reads beautifully and it is beautiful to look at as well. Thank you very much, Jackie Morris, illustrator of The Book of Birds, and to you, Robert McFarlane, author.
25 past eight. Talking of books, Anna is going to be presenting live towards the end of the month at the Hay Festival, the annual literature and arts festival held in Hay on Wye. So if you want to see her, if you want to watch the programme being broadcast live, you can see it all at Hay. Plus, of course, take part in the various book-oriented things that are going on there. You can register for free tickets for that morning, that Saturday morning. It's actually the 23rd of May. You can do it from now. You just go to the Hay Festival website. Mike, now at 26 minutes past eight with sport.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Justin. We now know that Arsenal will face Paris Saint-Germain in the final of the Champions League at the end of this month. The defending champions, PSG, drew 1-1 with Bayern Munich last night in the second leg of their semi-final. It meant they won the tie 6-5 on aggregate. So Paris Saint-Germain will take on Arsenal in Budapest in the Champions League final on Saturday, the 30th of May. Staying with football, we also have new Women's Super League champions. Yes, that was the moment. Manchester City's women celebrated being crowned WSL champions last night. They weren't playing themselves. Instead, the whole squad gathered at the Joy Stadium to watch their nearest title challengers, Arsenal, draw 1-1 at Brighton. Those dropped points from Arsenal meant City cannot now be caught at the top. Well, let's speak to Emma Sanders, BBC Women's football reporter. Hi, Emma.
Good morning.
This is Manchester City's first Women's Super League title for 10 years, isn't it? And I think most people can say a deserved one. They have dominated from start to finish this season.
Absolutely deserved. They've been top since the 9th of November. That's how much they've dominated. I think we've just been waiting for them to finally get their hands on the trophy, which they obviously haven't done yet. They will get their hands on it in their final game of the season. So they're very much looking forward to that. But yeah, they've been brilliant this season. I think they've been the top goal scorers in the league as well. They've just played some fantastic football. So a long time coming, thoroughly deserved.
What has been the difference for them this season?
I think manager Andre Jeglertz has made a massive impact since he arrived in the summer. He came fresh from managing Denmark at the Euros, and perhaps a little bit of an understated appointment, actually. People were a little bit cautious to see how he would get on. But pretty much as soon as he arrived, you could see a difference. I think the players have been playing really, you know, free, really creative. Some of their star players have been moved into slightly different positions, and it's got the best out of them. So, you know, you speak to any of the Manchester City players and they will say our manager has instilled a new winning mentality in us and a confidence that they perhaps didn't have before. So that's been a massive difference for them. And it's his debut season in the WSL, only the second manager in the competition's history to win it in their first season in England as well. So a phenomenal achievement for him on a personal level.
And this title for Manchester City, Emma, ends Chelsea's dominance of the Women's Super League, doesn't it? They have won the last six titles in a row, Chelsea. A new champion, I guess, is good for the competitiveness of the league.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of neutrals are quite happy to see a new name on there. Obviously, Chelsea won't be. They've had a really disappointing campaign for their standards. Also dropped out of the quarterfinals of the Champions League as well. They tend to go quite far in that competition. So, yeah, I think Sonia Bonpastor's side, who were unbeaten and won all three domestic titles last season, they really have had a drop-off. But obviously, Manchester City have taken advantage of that. And I think it's good to see the competition rise. I think you look at the likes of Arsenal as well, who have obviously been City's closest challengers this season as well. They're going to be right up there again next season moving forward. So there's three teams in there, and Manchester United obviously would love to throw their name in the hat, that are really challenging for these trophies now.
Emma Sanders, BBC Women's Football Reporter, many thanks for that this morning. The final round of WSL fixtures, when Manchester City will lift that WSL trophy, is the weekend after next, the 16th of May.
Thanks very much, Mike. In our time is coming up just after nine. Let's hear from Misha Glennie with the details.
Good morning. We'll be discussing Josef Roth, the great Austrian writer, or Joseph Roth as he's known in English. He's best known now for novels such as Radetzky March and Job, the story of a simple man. But he made his name as a journalist in Vienna and Berlin after the First World War, and he had a journalist's eye for the poignant details that told the story of the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the rise of Nazism. And yes, his books were among the first to be burnt after Hitler came to power. That's Josef Roth with Deborah Holmes, Helen Chambers and John Hughes on In Our Time on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 a.m. And now back to today.
And to the weather. It's going to be mostly cloudy. Parts of the east and south, though, will have some sunny spells, especially this morning.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Katia Adler. Time for a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
The UK Health Security Agency has told this programme that the risk to the wider public from an outbreak of hantavirus on a cruise ship is really negligible and there should be no cause for concern. Two British people who were on board the MV Hondius have returned to the UK and are self-isolating. A British man has also been airlifted from the ship and is receiving specialist treatment in the Netherlands. President Trump says it is very possible that a deal to end the war with Iran can be reached. Iranian officials say they're looking at a new proposal from the US, but their top negotiator has said Washington is aiming to force Tehran to surrender. The oil giant Shell has reported underlying earnings just over £5 billion for the first 3 months of the year. That's 24% higher than the same quarter in 2025. Four women with links to the Islamic State group are due to arrive in Australia shortly, along with nine children, after spending years in a detention camp in Syria. Before boarding their flight, they told journalists they were looking forward to going home and wanted the children to be safe.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 28 minutes to nine. A serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers are being investigated for potential misconduct in relation to the way the force handled reports of sexual abuse by Mohammed Al-Fayed, who owned Harrods between 1985 and 2010. He died in 2023 and had never faced any charges. It was only after the BBC documentary in September 2024, which exposed some of the sexual abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed, that the Met revealed it had been approached by 21 women before his death. Hundreds of women have since accused the former Harrods owner of rape, sexual assault and trafficking. Well, Justine is from the No One Above movement. It's a collective, that advocates for survivors. She's a survivor herself of Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed, and she joins me now down the line. Hello, Justine.
Hi, Katia. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you very much for speaking to us. I mean, this Met investigation that's been announced is particularly poignant to you, of course, because you reported the abuse you suffered to police at the time.
I did. I first reported to the Met back in 2018, and others had reported before that. But I was absolutely terrified at the time. I'd been under surveillance previously. I'd been threatened by Fayed's key security people in previous years. And of course, Fayed was still alive at that point. So despite speaking to the police and despite a file being opened and a crime number being issued, nothing further happened. And I was clearly a reluctant witness because of my fear, which was very real. But I now know from reading more recent press coverage that actually several other women were reporting similar crimes about the same person at the same time, and nothing came of any of those reports either. And that was really one of the last real opportunities for justice that we had while he was still alive, and it was missed.
Well, because of this investigation, what I'm wondering, I mean, you say that you, at the time, police did give you a case number. You say it was a missed opportunity of joining dots, but did you feel at the time that your allegations, that your report was being taken seriously?
No, it was a casual conversation. I felt it was just me, you know, who they were speaking to, and I was the only person that was having that sort of conversation with the police. I had been a part of a news piece previously, and that news piece just disappeared. You know, it came out and it disappeared. So I felt as if I was just speaking into a vacuum, and no action was being taken.
Well, you're being very, I mean, you're very brave to talk about it. I can hear, you know, the emotion in your voice. The Independent Office for Police Conduct says that the investigation now involves reports made by four individuals. They say it's been going on since January last year. Now, the Met Police apologised in July for distress calls. We have asked to speak to them. We've asked to speak to the IOPC as well. We've not had a response yet. But the IOPC says it still has to decide whether any current or former officers have or would have had, if they have a disciplinary case to answer. Do you feel, though, that a sense of people being held to account, at least now?
Well, you know, what we're seeing today, it is one more step, but, you know, this IOPC is a very long complaints process that's been going on for a considerable amount of time, and it's moving at a glacial pace. But what's absolutely vital is that these officers, although they do potentially have things to answer, they cannot be made scapegoats. You know, interrogating these officers does not put a lid on this whole thing as to the nature of this crime. You know, this is a huge trafficking enterprise that needs a full investigation. All the entire system, the financial flows, the NDAs, the FBOs, the medical testing, everything needs to be exposed and scrutinized. And there are many, many people who have played a part in this entire process for decades. And these few officers are small parts in the whole system.
So what you're saying is that, I mean, obviously Al-Fayed died in 2023, so there, you know, nothing more can be done, but you don't want this case to end with the current investigation with the serving Metropolitan Police officer and four former Met officers?
Absolutely not. No, this is one step. And there are thousands of steps to take.
Justine, from the No One Above, a collection collective that advocates for survivors of Mohammed Al-Fayed. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
And the time now is 22 minutes to 9. Let us talk for a minute about aliens, because America is obsessed with aliens. That obsession has been fed just a little bit more. First, Donald Trump saying some things very interesting to people are going to be released soon about aliens. And then former President Obama weighing in. He was asked by Stephen Colbert on The Late Show on American network CBS about whether or not the US government is keeping the existence of aliens a secret.
If there were aliens or alien spaceships or anything under the control of the United States government that we knew about, seen, photographs, what have you, I promise you some guy guarding the installation would have taken a selfie with one of the aliens and sent it to his girlfriend to impress him. It would leak.
That was former President Barack Obama. In the studio, Danny Lavelle, who is journalist and author of Chasing Aliens, Faith and Conspiracy in the UFO Heartlands, a book just out. Danny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Where does it start?
The book, well, it starts in America for me. I became attracted to the subject. Well, actually, I had no interest in aliens at all, actually, apart from maybe Star Wars as a kid. But then in 2017, an article appeared in the New York Times called Black Money and Glowing Auras Inside the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program. And this article featured a whistleblower called Luis Elizondo, who made an extraordinary claim that UFOs were making incursions over US military bases and were behaving in ways that defied the laws of physics. So this just wasn't just a story from like a rancher in the Midwest, you know, no offense to ranchers in the Midwest, but this was like a former spook. So and then over the years, the plot thickened. You had other whistleblowers saying not only were UFOs real and the Pentagon program existed, but we have the spaceships and the alien bodies. You had uber rationalists like the neuroscientist Sam Harris saying we might have to apologise to people we've been ridiculing for a very long time. So it was just like this paradigm shift. So I just felt myself getting drawn to it. You know, either there was an alien invasion going on under all our nose, or there's some very confused people in US intelligence.
You call it a paradigm shift. In a way, though, it's part of American life, is it fair to say, in a way that it isn't? Well, if you look at Britain and our interest in UFOs, which has been there, but we're not as obsessed, are we?
No, I say in the book that it's a big slice of Americana, really. I think it all began in 1947 with Roswell. And if you look at when that happened just after the war. The British Empire was finished. Europe was a mess. America emerged as the world superpower. And there's this paradox with being very powerful, you're also very vulnerable at the same time. So this fear of the other, of threats grew. You had McCarthyism, the Red Scare, and then the following decade, you had the JFK assassination, Watergate. So this sense of a dark hand manipulating things from the shadows was sort of embedded in the American psyche. Add to that the sci-fi boom and Hollywoodification of UFOs. It was perfect.
And the elision of truth and fantasy, which is another aspect of Americana, isn't it? There was a wonderful book called Fantasyland written a few years ago about how, way before Trump, it was possible for people to say things that seem not to be true and maybe to believe them, maybe not to believe them, in a way, both in public and in private, in a way that you don't see in other countries.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know what that's about. I don't know why Americans have that frame of mind. All I can say is that I think one of the reasons why it's come back into the zeitgeist now is because of this era of unreality we all find ourselves in, where the facts and lies and misinformation are all tangled together like a web, and it's difficult to separate them all.
Although, I mean, as lies and misinformation, etc. But actually, as you say, and as you pointed out, some perfectly rational people think there is something at least to be investigated here.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that there are unidentified flying objects, but the leap is that they're aliens. So that's a distinction worth making. I have to say, the distances between solar systems make the prospect of an alien invasion quite unlikely.
What do you think Donald Trump's going to come up with then? Is it going to be like the other things that he's promised and not quite delivered?
I think so. I think this is straight from his playbook. He positions himself as this sort of political outsider, and he's going to go in and expose the dark hand of the deep state. And just like every conspiracy theory, it's like a feedback loop. So when inevitably they don't you know, release photos of aliens and the spaceships and hangars, you can say, oh, well, they're even hiding it from me, the president. So he's got a perfect get-out clause. It appeals to his base. Also, his vice president, Vance, says he's obsessed with UFOs, but he doesn't think they're aliens. He thinks they're demons. So it helps him a lot, this thing. It's a nice distraction from Iran and the other things he's involved in, like Venezuela and deportations and so on.
Danny Lavelle, thank you very much. The book, by the way, Chasing Aliens, Faith and Conspiracy in the UFO Heartlands, and it's out now.
It's 16 minutes to 9. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Well, that's what the saying tells us. And trade across the Strait of Hormuz, as we know, has been strangled as a result of the Iran war, with energy prices and fertilizer prices being affected, with effects on lives and livelihoods across the world. We've got the on-again, off-again news that the straits will open and they won't open. And in the meantime, new trade routes are beginning to emerge. We've heard from the global shipping giant, the Mediterranean Shipping Company, MSC, for example, that it's just opened a new trade route linking key European ports with Saudi Arabia and other regional hubs. Well, Ahmed Al-Hosi is CEO of Fertiglobe, one of the world's biggest exporters of nitrogen fertilizer. He spoke to my business colleague Will Bain this morning about the consequences of the closure of the straits.
The U.S., a lot of the farmland sits in the Midwest. Those farmers need to have the product on a barge in the U.S. Gulf Coast at the Mississippi River. They need to have that by mid-May to make it in time for their season. If the strait opens tomorrow, there's no way product will arrive from the Arab Gulf within, you know, this short time period of, you know, 8-9 days. It's about also the logistical movements. When it opens, can it get there in time for when that farmer needs it in Australia and Brazil and South Asia? And the other element of it is, it's not just that the Strait of Hormuz needs to open. You need to start generating product again at some of the producers.
Well, the CEO of Maersk, Vincent Clerc, spoke to the BBC this morning. He described the impact of the war on the global shipping industry.
The price of fuel that has nearly doubled, that implies about $500 million of extra cost per month since the beginning of this. We can do some on pressing the cost agenda further, but for us, what is really important is actually to pass on these cost increases to our customers as much as possible so that we can protect our margin and the operations integrity going forward.
Marco Forgioni is Director General of the Chartered Institute of Export and International Trade, and he joins me now. Good morning to you.
Morning, Katja.
So you've got hundreds of vessels struck in the Strait of Hormuz. What contingency plans specifically are being put in place? And also, I mean, how long will they take to organise rerouting, you know, undersea pipelines? That's not an overnight thing you can do, is it?
So in the short term, the rerouting is taking place, and you've just identified opening of new trade routes, the diversion is taking place to avoid the Strait of Hormuz. But the real issue is the product and supply that was due to come out of the Gulf, which has been stopped. And that is going to have both a short-term and indeed a medium-term impact just on the reduction in global trade, which has a deflationary pressure, but raises the risk of stagflation. And unfortunately, the impact on growing seasons, particularly in nations that can probably least afford it. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, who are dependent on fertilizers coming from the Gulf that won't be available for the key growing season.
Which is why there is the search now to try and find alternative routes. But do you think, because of the constant discussion around whether it will open or not, and even if it is open, that waterway, at the moment there's a sense that it could be closed again at any time. Is this a moment where the Strait of Hormuz, we have to say, won't any longer be a key transport network for the fertilizer, for the oil and everything else?
It will remain important in the short term. But there is huge investment going in already to diversify the supply chains, to move to a much more multimodal land, rail, sea routes that will bypass the Strait of Hormuz. So the opening up of the ports of Fujairah for the UAE, and as was just highlighted with the opening of the Red Sea ports for Saudi Arabia, that investment will mean that there's going to be a much bigger impact on the integrated global supply chains, and we'll be moving towards a resilient multi-source supply chain rather than the really fragile single source that has grown up for the past 50 years.
Marco Forgione, thank you, because, I mean, I suppose we're moving into a period where all waterways in the region are under question because the Houthis have affected the Red Sea as well. But thank you very much indeed for your time.
And the time now is 11 minutes to nine.
The President versus the Pope. Now, that is how it's felt in recent weeks. That's since Donald Trump's unprecedented verbal attacks against the first ever American pontiff a few weeks ago. And it's the backdrop when the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, meets Pope Leo today in the Vatican's Apostolic Palace. It's characterized as a war of words in the media, but I wonder if that's how Pope Leo views it. Well, with me is Cardinal Vincent Nichols, former leader of the Catholic Church in England and Wales. How do you think Pope Leo is seeing the tensions with Donald Trump?
I think he will see them as part of a long course in church history of dialogue and tension between political leadership and religious leadership. And I think he... Today, I would expect he'd hope for some more particulars about what's going on between the United States and Iran, because clearly, as we've heard, headlines change every day. The attitude switches between threat and negotiation. So maybe the Pope will receive some information there that will help him to know and understand the situation. But as I say, this is a constant part of church history. You know, I remember very vividly 2010 when Pope Benedict came to Westminster and was in Westminster Hall, and he addressed these issues directly as to what is the relative roles of political leadership and faith. And he made some categorical statements like, it is not the role of religion to provide on its own rational arguments for courses of action. And it's certainly not the role of religion to put forward political solutions. But Pope Leo will simply keep addressing and underlining gospel imperatives that we work for the good of humanity, for a common good, and we strive always for peace. I think it's very important. Sorry.
Do continue.
Well, I think it's very important to remember this spat of words took place when Pope Leo was going to Africa. And he went through four African countries. And in Cameroon, he spoke a great deal about peace and what it means to work for peace. And he kept saying this is not simply a cessation of violence, but working for peace means bringing people together, helping those whose lives have been ruined, working for new stability and even for forgiveness. As he said, it only takes moments to destroy, but it takes more than a lifetime to rebuild. And that would be his emphasis and the church's emphasis. And he praised the people of the Cameroons for working in this way. That's the broader context of these comments.
Well, that the Pope should speak about peace presumably would come as no surprise, but Donald Trump seemed to get very upset. I mean, he accused the Pope, let's be clear, of supporting nuclear weapons, of endangering Catholics with his stance against the Iran war. Is there a surprise in the Vatican that Donald Trump seems to have taken Pope Leo's words so personally? I mean, would the Vatican ever see that there is ever such a thing as a just war?
Well, the Catholic position has long been that it is possible for there to be a just war. The development of armaments and their impact, and even the fact that often they're directed by artificial intelligence, all of these things have an impact on an understanding of what a just war might be. But I think the considered opinions is that the requirements for a just war are not met in this conflict, on and off conflict, between the US and Iran, not least, you know, because there should, in the just war theory, be an immediate threat that has to be defended. Iran's nuclear program is not an immediate threat. And there has to be a clear aim, and it's not exactly clear. But that's why I think today's meeting might help to clarify what is the balance going on between dialogue, discussions about how this can be ended, and the threat of further violence and a resumption of conflict. And maybe there'll be some more clarity about that between the Holy See and the American administration.
Maybe. Cardinal Vincent Nichols, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you very much indeed. That was Cardinal Vincent Nichols, former leader of the Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales. And he, by the way, was one of the 133 cardinals shut into the Vatican Sistine Chapel and who later elected Pope Leo.
6 minutes to nine is the time. Ted Turner died yesterday, the man who invented CNN. Back in 1980, he launched that 24-hour cable news network out of a renovated Atlanta country club. The networks in New York and Los Angeles rather shrugged at the time. News they thought had a schedule. It happened at 6:30 in the evening and again at 11 for people who'd missed the 6:31. Ted Turner, of course, changed all that, and he changed it around the world. President Trump called him one of the greats of broadcast history. Few would argue with that. There was a time that CNN really did dominate the world. In the early 90s in particular, there was no escaping it in hotel rooms and government offices, absolutely everywhere. Let us talk about CNN, its past and indeed potentially its future, but also the legacy of Ted Turner with David Yellen, former editor of The Sun, co-host of the Radio 4 podcast When It Hits the Fan, who's here in the studio. And Jane Hill is on the line, presenter of the 6 and 10 o'clock news on the BBC, The World Tonight as well, but was one of the first faces on the BBC's CNN effort, the 24-hour news channel that we launched, News 24. Jane, good morning to you as well.
Morning, Justin. Yes, effort is the word in the early days, right. I'm afraid, as far as
Well, I want to get to that, because it wasn't an easy thing to do. And that, I suppose, is the first point, Dave Yellen, isn't it, to start with, that when he started it, this wasn't an obvious surefire winner by any means at all.
He was way ahead, and you know, it's very common for innovators, mavericks, to be ahead and not, you know, have the idea. Because, I mean, Rupert Murdoch launched Sky 9 years after CNN and Fox News 16 years after CNN. And, of course, Rupert Murdoch has kept control of Fox News, whereas actually Ted Turner lost control of CNN. He did change the world. He had brilliant ideas, but he was unable to keep control. And I think ended his life with huge regrets around that.
Jane, when it comes to actually doing 24-hour news, one of the things that was really striking about CNN when they were at their best, and I'm thinking, I suppose, of the early 90s when you did see it everywhere, is how slick it was, because it's not easy to do, is it?
Well, it takes a while to make it slick, and isn't it interesting that CNN launched in 1980 and wasn't perceived to have come of age really for more than 10 years until the first Gulf War in the early 90s, and it's perhaps harder to do than it looks, dare I suggest, and certainly I used the word effort at the beginning of our chat, and we have to put it out there. News 24, as it was called then on the BBC, had a very difficult launch. The technology just wasn't up to it. And anyone who remembers it at the time, you probably do, Justin, we would fall off air, packages went to black, we lost correspondence. I mean, it was really, really hard work. And there was a lot of internal and external criticism. What was the BBC doing trying to launch this newfangled 24-hour thing? But it takes time to bed in. And I think the BBC thought, we have to do it. This is the future. Ted Turner created this, as David rightly points out. And it's the way the industry was going. And it took some years to come good.
That's really interesting. You say this is the future, because now, of course, David Yellen, is not the future, is it? Indeed, it's not possibly even the present.
Well, Twitter, Facebook, you know, only a few years old. In 2006, Twitter was invented, believe it or not. It's very, very recent.
Because you used to go to a hotel room and you'd stick it on. You'd stick CNN on to see what's going on. You'd never do that now, would you?
Ted Turner was a very lucky general. You know, he had the fall of Berlin Wall, 89, Tiananmen Square, 89, and then Peter Arnett. Remember, he was the only journalist in Baghdad in the first Gulf War. He wasn't a journalist, you know. He didn't really like news before. He never really watched it. He never interfered. You know, I don't think anyone who ever ran CNN during that time when he was running it, he almost looked down on the journalists. He was an extraordinary character. And I think, as I said earlier, the fact that he lost control of CNN is a critical thing. And you know, people don't quite understand that. I think he was worth $3 to $8 billion. We don't know when he died, but he wasn't a happy man because he lost control of his baby.
The thing that did make him happy, though, was philanthropy, wasn't it? And he did.
He gave $1 billion to the UN. I met him a few times. He was the most extraordinary person. He hated Rupert Murdoch, and I thought it was interesting yesterday that that Rupert Murdoch.
What do you think of Trump?
Very nice.
Trump really was very nice about him, wasn't he?
You know, what's really interesting about Trump, and we haven't got all day, is that nobody was talking about him back then. You know, they just, right. He just thought it was a joke. But anyway, that's another.
Okay.